I'm told that the first presenter at the community law center, there is a change in the name of presenter, and the current presenter is Lucas. Is he here? Okay. I hope you have a microphone next to you. Please proceed. Hello? I didn't hear that.
Shall I come to the front?
I'm partially sighted, so if you sit at closer, it's your advantage at the second. It would be nice if we can cozy up a little bit and come closer so that the chair can also see. Otherwise, we'll only be able to hear you. Please take a seat.
Thank you, Chairperson. This submission is by the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative, a project of the Community Law Center at the University of the Western Cape. I will follow roughly the written submission and just raise issues as a matter of emphasis. The submission focuses specifically on the UN Convention Against Torture, Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, as well as the optional protocol to the convention.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. I forgot to mention another important matter. We are here considering the Children's Amendment Bill. This bill is intended to amend the current Children's Act 2005, which kicked in this part of it on the 1st of July this year. Now, I know that there has been a lot of interest in the Principal Act and some of the matters dealt with there, but the focus of these proceedings are confined to the contents of the amendment though. So we would really urge people to focus on that, because everything else that's outside of that scope, we can't really use it in any way, because the act is not before us. What's before us is the amendment though. I hope that's clear. Sorry for the rude interruption. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So, as I said, this submission focuses on two pieces of international law, the Convention Against Torture and the Optional Protocol to the Convention Against Torture. Just for clarification purposes, the definition of torture has essentially four requirements, the first being that such an act must be intentional, secondly, it must be committed by a public official or at the behest or acquiescence of a public official. It must result in severe mental and physical suffering, pain and suffering, and it excludes pain and suffering as a result of lawful actions. So in essence, the purpose of the Convention Against Torture is to ensure that perpetrators are prosecuted, that they are held accountable, and that they are punished appropriately. So this submission is supportive of the bill, and we welcome the measures introduced by the bill to protect children, especially when they are deprived of their liberty. It is regrettable that torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of children still take place in South African facilities where children are detained or temporarily reside. Widespread abuse and what could amount to torture was reported in 2005 at the George Hofmeyr High School, a school of industries. In a more recent case involving the assault and solitary confinement of a group of children at the Etukomala Reform School in Mpumalanga was reported, and conditions at the Nkosuweni place of safety in Port Elizabeth was also recently featured in the media. So I think one has to accept that these violations take place and that the necessary legislative protections need to be taken. The committee's attention is also drawn to the fact that despite South Africa's ratification of the Convention Against Torture in 1998, the act of torture has not yet been criminalized under South African law, as is required by Article 4 of the Convention. And the UN Committee Against Torture lamented this fact in its concluding remarks in November 2006. The right to freedom and security of the person is described in 5 subsections of the Constitution, 2 of which are non-derogable. So I think the argument is strong that one needs to take additional measures to protect people deprived of their liberty, especially children. I will not go into the international status of the prohibition of torture. This is described in the submission, but suffice to say that this has the status of peremptory norm, and nothing can allow a deviation from this. I will now turn to clauses 106 and 139 of the bill on page 4 of our written submission. Clause 139 deals with the discipline of children, and clause 139, paragraph 2, attempts to protect children against punishment that is cruel, inhuman, and degrading. It further specifically prohibits the use of corporal punishment. Clause 139(5)(a) and (b) deals with the training of staff in respect of the prohibition of corporal punishment and the promotion of appropriate discipline. While we are supportive of these measures, the bill raises a number of issues with reference to the Convention Against Torture. The focus on discipline may not be of sufficient scope to provide adequate protection for children against torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, as alluded to in Clause 159, paragraph 1 of the bill, with reference to the Constitution. Children may be subjected to torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment outside the context of discipline. Clause 106 of the bill makes reference to a child that has been abused in a manner causing physical injury, sexually abused, or deliberately neglected. This definition is, in our view, in fact limiting, as it does not include mental suffering. In view of this, it is proposed that the bill incorporates the definition of torture as defined in Article 1 of the Convention Against Torture and its absolute prohibition as a general protective measure. The full definition is given in the written submission. I won't repeat it here. It is furthermore important to read the definition in Article 1 together with Article 16 of CAT, which essentially transfers those obligations to the protection against acts that may not constitute torture, but may constitute cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. With reference to Clause 159(5)(a) and (b), providing for education and awareness raising, as well as the promotion of appropriate discipline, we draw the committee's attention to Article 10 of the Convention Against Torture, which states, each state party shall ensure that education and information regarding the prohibition against torture are fully included in the training of law enforcement personnel, civil or military, medical personnel, public officials, and other persons who may be involved in the custody, interrogation, or treatment of any individual subjected to any form of arrest, detention, or imprisonment. Each state party shall include this prohibition in the rules or instructions issued in regard to the duties and functions of any such person. The prevention of torture remains, after all, the most important objective of the Convention, and the Committee Against Torture has on numerous occasions reminded state parties that this starts with ensuring that persons working with detained persons, including children, are made aware of the absolute prohibition of torture. From the wording of Article 1, one can assume that the Department of Social Development should at minimum have a policy in respect of the prevention of torture or other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. Such a policy, the regulations, and operating procedures should form the basis for the training of staff, ensuring that every official is familiar with the required standards and what is considered as prohibited and a violation of the Convention. We therefore submit that Clause 139(4) and 5 be amended to incorporate the general prohibition of torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, and not be limited to punishment and corporal punishment in particular. I will now turn to Clause 191 to 194 of the bill. Clause 191 provides for the establishment of child and youth care centres, and these centres provide a wide range of services and various categories of children to be placed there. I will draw the committee's attention to Article 11 of the Convention, which states that each state party shall keep under systematic review interrogation rules, instructions, methods, and practices, as well as arrangements for the custody and treatment of persons subjected to any form of arrest, detention, or imprisonment in any territory under its jurisdiction, with a view to preventing any cases of torture. The written submission goes into a fair amount of detail on what the systematic review means, and we are suggesting that this be done on a four-year basis. We're taking its cue from Article 19.1 of the Convention Against Torture. The norms and standards referred to in Clause 194 of the Bill would then fall under the rules and procedures referred to in Article 11 of the Convention, and we therefore submit that Clause 194 be amended to provide for the regular review of these norms and standards. It is furthermore our submission that such a review be done every 4 years. In paragraph 19 of our submission, we draw the committee's attention to the fact that there is at present no independent visiting mechanism in place to provide oversight over places where children are detained and reside. In line with Article 11 of the Convention Against Torture, it is thus submitted that such a structure be provided for by law to conduct visits on a regular and unannounced basis to youth care centers. The purpose of such visits will be to inspect facilities and services rendered, to consult with children and record complaints, to resolve complaints lodged by children, to address other concerns with the management of the center, and if need be, report unresolved complaints and or rights violations to the appropriate authority. We suggest to the committee that the independent prison visitors, as created by Chapter 10 of the Correctional Services Act, is a possible model that can be investigated to address the issue of independent oversight. We furthermore support the norms and standards set out under Clause 194 of the Bill. However, we wish to draw the committee's attention to Article 13 of the Convention Against Torture, which states that each state party shall ensure that any individual who alleges he has been subjected to torture in any territory under its jurisdiction has the right to complain to and to have his case promptly and impartially examined by its competent authorities. Steps shall be taken to ensure that the complainant and witnesses are protected against all ill treatment or intimidation as a consequence of his complaint or any evidence given. Article 13 of CAT gives everyone who claims to have been tortured the right to complain and to have the case examined promptly and impartially. There's extensive research that has been done by other organizations to describe the problems with complaints mechanisms, and these are presented in the written submission. I'll not repeat it here. So given the complexities outlined regarding this issue and the vulnerability of children, we submit that Clause 194, Paragraph 2, be amended to make specific reference to the development of norms and standards that will apply to all child and youth care centers in respect of complaints mechanisms and procedures. We also wish to draw the committee's attention to Article 12 of the Convention that deals with the investigation of complaints of torture and requiring that such cases be investigated in a prompt and impartial manner, and that it is not necessary for a complaint to have been lodged. It is sufficient wherever there is reasonable ground to believe that an act of torture has been committed, there thus arises an obligation to investigate such a complaint. The written submission gives some more detail on that. In paragraph 28, we then submit that in view of the requirements of Article 12 of the Convention Against Torture, we submit that Clause 194, Paragraph 2, be amended to provide for norms and standards applicable to all youth care centers in respect of the investigation of allegations of torture and other forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. South Africa has also signed the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, and we wish to draw the committee's attention to this fact. It firstly provides for an international visiting mechanism to any place of detention, including places where children are detained. It furthermore provides for the establishment of a national preventive mechanism with essentially the same powers. Essentially, it means that these two structures can at any time visit a place where people, including children, are detained. I will not go into the detail of that. I understand the Human Rights Commission is also part of establishing such a process. But it essentially means that all places where children are detained are subject to the visits by these two structures. And we therefore submit that the bill needs to be amended to provide for the full cooperation of child and youth care center management as well as the Department of Social Development when the International Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture and or the National Preventive Mechanism visit such a facility. The cooperation requirements in terms of the department are described in Article 20, Article 19 and Article 20 of the optional protocol. These are given in the written submission. I will not repeat it here. That concludes our submission, Chairperson.
Thank you, CLC. Fresh, interesting perspective, which I'm sure members would love to engage you on. I am going to immediately invite members of the committee to raise any questions of clarity. The way we work is that members can make comments, can ask questions, to clarify issues. But it's essentially an interaction between members and the presenter. I don't know if there are any takers. Is that Ms. Dudley? Please go ahead.
What I'd like to ask is, has the present law, which is the reasonable society wording, made it impossible for parents to be found, not only parents, but authorities to be found guilty where there's been abuse? Or has it just not been applied where there has been abuse? And with defining parental corporal punishment, for example, still expose children to a lack of protection, in that we obviously, you know, you're speaking about torture, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment, which obviously violates the convention, which is totally different, of course, to loving parental discipline. So we're talking here about the need for greater definition of those particular concepts. Now, would that not be adequate to define specifically what we mean about torture, cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment that which violates the convention without somehow kind of trying to pull the parental discipline into it in some way? Would that not cover it? My understanding, I know there's one submission that speaks about defining specifically parental corporal punishment, and that being helpful, because then you see exactly what that is as opposed to what we discuss as torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, which we all know goes on and is unacceptable. So I hope that you can get my drift.
Thank you. I'm going to invite a couple of questions before I give it back to the presenter to respond. Any further takers? Okay. I just wanted to raise my own question. First of all, obviously, the history of corporal punishment as dealt with in the bill has triggered a lot of interest, and we would want to be addressed specifically on that issue, and in view of the fact that you have touched upon a slightly related issue, which you feel needs to be brought into that whole area or arena as an addition. Perhaps you could start by addressing us on the existing tool insofar as it bans, if you like, capital punishment. What your views are on that, and linked to that, whether in your view there are any particular constitutional imperatives based, amongst others, on previous court interpretations in relation to in short, whether this committee has any particular constitutional obligation in considering this particular matter. That is the one issue. The second issue I want to raise with you is you're raising the issue of a whole convention, which I would presume is not aimed exclusively at protecting children, but at protecting all people who may be vulnerable to torture. I have in mind the Domestic Violence Act and what happens to women who are victims of abuse, be it in the home or elsewhere, including the workplace for that matter. I'm thinking of a whole host of other scenarios that might not involve children. The question I have is, wouldn't it be a piecemeal approach for us to attempt to give effect to that convention in the context of this legislation? Shouldn't that matter be left to be dealt with as a separate, comprehensive process of looking at developing legislation to give effect to that particular convention? And just finally, in relation to the norms and standards in facilities for children and in relation to grievance procedures, etc., what are the specific suggestions you make? I hear you saying that norms and standards need to be developed. Pardon me, I do not have the submission in front of me now, but maybe you have dealt with that matter in very specific terms. If you have done so, I don't have to go to any detail. But I just wanted to get a sense of what exactly you propose there. Right. I do not see any further hands. Is there somebody? Oh, I'm told I have a bedroom voice, so I'll try and raise it. Okay, I understand there's another hand in the back.
Yes, my question is basically on with the complex.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Heidi Souls, and I'm an anthropologist.
Well, can I just indicate that only members of parliament are allowed to ask questions.
So what would be the public inclusion then?
Sorry?
What would be the public inclusion then of the question?
Okay, let me explain it to you very slowly.
It's my first time here, exactly.
Okay, yes. Okay, let me explain it to you very slowly. This committee, which is a committee on social development, is currently considering legislation. And to assist it in finalizing this legislation, it has invited members of the public to submit written submissions to it on any matter contained in this legislation. Over and above that, it has arranged this public hearing for those that have made this written submission to address the committee orally on any issues of emphasis that they would want to focus the committee's attention on. So the exercise is structured in this way. Those that have made the request by the deadline of Friday noon last week have now been given the opportunity to interact with the committee. So So it is an exchange between those members of the public that have made the specific request in terms of the invitation, in the public invitation, to interact with the community. So unfortunately, that is the way in which the arrangement is made. Have you made the request to address the committee?
Can I respond to that? I actually have a written submission. I submitted
can
that.
Can I indicate that if you are on the program, when your turn comes, you would have an opportunity to interact with this committee. You can exchange with another presenter outside of the proceedings, but different presenters do not have the liberty to interact amongst themselves. All presenters have the liberty to interact with the committee, and that's the structure. So when your turn comes, if you want to challenge any specific issue that any presenter has raised, of course you'd be perfectly at liberty to do so, and we will listen to what you have to say. I don't know if that provides clarity. Okay. On that basis, can we then proceed? Those are the questions that have been put to you. Let's see. And if there's still time, we might have another round. But I don't. Please go proceed.
Thank you, Jason. I will deal with the questions in the order that they were presented. Essentially, the first question I've understood is whether one can define parental chastisement as an additional protection measure. Am I understanding it incorrectly? Can I answer this?
Please clarify.
Just
let me
see if it was around the existing law.
Can I just say, well, let me just paraphrase you, and if I'm not succeeding, you'll clarify. The way I understand intervention is that doesn't the notion of reasonable chastisement isn't it self-containing in itself, in the sense that it is a balanced framework that separates what would constitute torture or abuse, etc., from what would constitute discipline. And that therefore, in a sense, I think she's saying that the doing away with that or the further regulation of the issue of discipline outside that concept of reasonable chastisement, in a sense, does not address the issue. I'm just trying to paraphrase this. But just clarify further.
Thank you. The two aspects. The one was in terms especially of parental corporal punishment, is it reasonable chastisement in itself that is making it impossible for courts to deal with abuse? Or has it just not been utilized adequately in terms of dealing with abuse of children? The other part was, would defining corporal punishment, parental corporal punishment, still expose children to lack of protection? And I referred there to some of the suggestions that we had, which have suggested that we do that. And then, following on from what you have said, it seems likely to me that it is actually much better to simply define what the problem actually is, and that is the abuse, the torture, cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment which violates the convention, rather than actually trying to make that somehow fit something that it doesn't fit, and that it would be much clearer if we actually define what we're talking about, and would that make sense to you?
Thank you, Chair. The definition issue has been one that has been occupying scholars, legal and otherwise, for very long. And I think the definition of torture, as it is taken up in the convention, was deliberately drafted in such an open and almost expansive manner, so that it does not list specific activities, whether it is parental chastisement or anything like that. as a specific act of torture, but it essentially requires that it must be intentional and it must result in severe mental and physical suffering. And I think that is probably the better definition that we have at the moment to work with. Being specific about what is and what is not torture does not seem to be a very productive approach. So my view would then be, and our submission did not deal specifically with corporal punishment in any form of detail, but then would probably one would need to go for a more general definition as is enunciated in the definition of torture. That would provide children with better protection than trying to list specific acts such as corporal punishment.
So you believe that if we live out the regulation of discipline out of the group and just have a clause that prohibits torture of children, that should adequately, and based on the convention, which you say is very comprehensive, that would adequately address the problem in relation to children.
Chairperson, I'm not thinking on my feet. So I think it is about communicating that definition properly and thoroughly to everybody involved, especially in public institutions or run for the state. And then applying the test whether any action has resulted in severe mental or physical suffering. Corporal punishment is just one possible form of punishment that can severely affect children. There are other forms of psychological and emotional abuse and torture that can be just as harming, if not more harmful. So in principle, I would support a more comprehensive approach such as defined in the definition of torture. Okay. The second question related to constitutional imperatives and whether this committee has a constitutional imperative to deal with the issue of torture in reference to this bill. I would submit yes. What we have found essentially is that the provisions in the constitution in section 12 D and E makes reference to torture, but there is no other legislation in South Africa that makes reference to torture. And the convention also encourages state parties to keep under regular review all rules and procedures and practices and legislation as well. So, and it does relate to the third question that was asked. In the sense that it is important for specific sectors, whether it be prisons or children deprived of their liberty or psychiatric institutions, that they should develop sector-specific legislation and regulations and procedures and mechanisms to give effect to the provisions of the Convention Against Torture. The criminalization of torture itself, as required by Article 4 of the Convention, my view is, yes, that is something that should be dealt with on a comprehensive national basis. But where it concerns the detention of particular categories of people, such as children, I think it is important for the responsible department to take to develop legislation and procedures that deals with it in that particular sector. So I think I have dealt with the third question as well. The last question around norms and standards, we have not made a specific submission of how these should be dealt with. In respect of investigations, there is the UN-approved Istanbul Protocol on the investigation of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. So there is a specific procedure set out for that. That covers the criminal investigation as well as the forensic medical investigation. In terms of complaint procedures, we deal with it briefly in the written submission just on what are the basic requirements, but I think there are examples that one can look at domestically, especially in respect of the PRISM system, where the Judicial Inspectorate of PRISMs have already developed certain practices and norms and standards on how to deal with complaints by prisoners. I think one can look at those as a starting point and see how one can make such complaints procedures more child-friendly. Our investigation in preparation of the submission revealed that there is not a great amount of consistency in existing complaints procedures, and we believe that it's very important to bring those into legislation, especially and more specifically into the regulations to the Act. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we have gone past the 30-minute mark, I understand, and we have scheduled only 20 minutes for presentation and interaction, given the number of submissions that we have to, or presentations that we have to plow through. I just wanted, maybe let me give Ms. Weber one last bite, because she's senior.
I would just like to hear in a nutshell, if the presenter would actually find that what we have in 191 is insufficient, and would he prefer it to be just withdrawn, because I find, you know, and reconstituted around the definition of torture, because I find that the definition of torture should actually not be included in the children's bill. That sounds very draconian, but it should rather belong to the justice bill that protects children. So I would really and truly hate to see that we would have torture mentioned in here, or would he just prefer that we have the definition of torture included in the bill? Thank you, Chair.
In fact, before he responds, just a follow-up to that point. You have two areas in this legislation. The one area deals with protection of children against abuse, neglect, etc. And there, you have a whole host of measures designed, which I think the presenter also alluded to, are designed to actually protect children from this form, physical, emotional, and otherwise, of abuse of children. And then you have the specific challenge in society of corporal punishment and other forms of punishment that is, harmful to children. Now, discipline is the specific issue because of the exemption or the defense at common law against any assault charge, which would be if you assault the child as part of what at common law would fit in as reasonable suspicion, and then you are not committing the crime of assault. Now, you're saying, no, now, the argument is, aren't these measures sector specific, responding to what could be aspects of torture, but more specific in relation to children, and therefore more appropriate as opposed to a general gloss on torture in relation to children, rather than having the regulation of torture generally as a matter, as you said earlier, that does with the National Congress. Is there somebody who? Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. As with regard to the definition of torture and whether it should be in the bill or not, I think it is of sufficient importance that one can include it in order to ensure that its absolute prohibition is communicated to all officials. For us, the issue is whether the officials who are working with children, whether they are government employees or operating a private operator, use case center, that they must understand the absolute prohibition of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. And this is an international obligation. It is an obligation that is reflected in the Constitution. So I think one needs to be bold here and include it in order to protect children against torture and also reflect that this includes mental and physical suffering. One can always add to the definition, but the Committee Against Torture is clear on this. It says, start at least with this definition. You can always add to it. I would support that one brings in the definition and the absolute prohibition of torture into the bill. The protection against abuse and neglect, in our submission, we focus specifically on child and youth care centers, where children are deprived of their liberty. And so it does not deal with the other instances where children are potentially vulnerable to abuse and neglect. And in this case, we believe that it's important to incorporate the definition of the prohibition against torture to ensure that perpetrators are investigated, that they are held accountable, and that they are convicted of the crime of torture once such legislation has been enacted. So in the case of corporal punishment, I think it's fairly straightforward in that such a punishment can absolutely not be allowed in a facility where children are deprived of their liberty. And lastly, the issue of assault. The Committee Against Torture has on numerous occasions commented that the common law crime of assault is not sufficient to cover the crime of torture because firstly the laws of prescription applies, and secondly that it does not cover mental suffering. So one cannot prosecute somebody for emotional torture of a child or an adult.
Okay, that's as far as we can take that submission. Interesting fresh perspective that we have to engage with. We're going to proceed without any waste of further time with the Legal Resources Center. And there is Ms. Sarah Septon. Can I encourage the presenters gravitate more and show the benches nearer here so that I at least can have the benefit of remembering your face?
I'm from the Legal Resource Center in Grantstown. I'm an attorney practicing there. My submissions today are focused around child and youth care centers.
But last get going.
No, he's now a judge.
Pardon me.
I've got copies of my submissions if they need it. My input today is going to be focused around my office's experience of assisting child and youth care centers in the UK. We represent a range of clients, from individuals who have had children placed within the spaces of safety, children's homes, and work with the Centre for Child Law on issues around reform schools. So I'll start with the issue of safety, temporary safety for children, pending final placement. Children are placed with either individuals or in children's homes as a temporary measure pending final placement. Part of the problem is that they are entitled to a fee. At the moment, it's 12 rand a day per child, and the Eastern Cape Department of Social Development doesn't have a proper system for processing these applications for fees or paying these fees. The result was that for over the period of at least 3 years, no safety fees were paid, and legal action was required. We first intervened in terms of trying to settle the matter out of, well, before instituting legal action, despite the fact that we met with senior officials in the Department of Social Development, we were unable to resolve the matter. This is despite the fact that there is no defence in law. The Commissioner of Child Welfare had ordered the safety fees to be paid. We instituted legal action in October last year. There was an immediate commitment to settle the case. Despite the immediate commitment to settle the case, our clients only got paid in June of this year, over 8 months later. Some of them were due 12 rand a day for a period of 3 years. Unfortunately, many of the people who look after children don't have private financial resources to look after children, and without the cooperation of the Department of Social Development, it places a completely unreasonable burden upon them to care for children.
These are places of safety that are run by private individuals who you're saying there is a system in terms of which they then get paid fees for the services they render. Okay, thank you.
It also includes children's homes where there's a space, a small amount of space in children's homes to have paid children on a temporary basis. What often happens with these children's homes is that it's not their core business to provide temporary places for safety. They operate in longer term homes, but there's a lot of pressure on them to take children to place of safety because there are not many places for children to go to. When children are abused, they have to be removed from their homes or they're abandoned. There's actually a shortage of places where they can go to, so you find well-run children's homes actually being overburdened with cases by social workers, who are employed by the Department of Social Development. So the department is placing the children there, but they're not doing their job in terms of processing payment fees, which places an extremely unreasonable burden on the children, on the people running the homes. Then we also deal with children's homes. Children's homes are, in the current legislation, there is a discretion for the minister to provide funding. We hope that this will become an obligation and not a discretion. The children's homes have great difficulty in accessing their grants. They have to submit extremely onerous business plans. They submit the business plans, they submit funding requests. Their requests for funding aren't even acknowledged, let alone responded to. Our office has to intervene to find out A, if the business plan has been received, B, when the funding application will be considered. And without a lot of hard work on our side, many of these children's homes would not get the funding that is due to them, despite the fact that they are caring for a large number of children. All of these homes do private fundraising, but this is not sufficient to care for the children. We also find that there are children's homes that are not registered, and so they're operating outside the parameters of the law. It's imperative that children's homes are registered. However, the problem is that they apply to get registered, and the first thing that has to happen is they have to be visited by an official from the Department of Social Development, and the visit never happens. So despite repeated requests for somebody from the Department of Social Development to attend to the request for registration, these steps are not taken. This doesn't just happen with children's homes in the Eastern Cape. It happens with early childhood development or creches. There are many creches that are operating outside the parameters of the law because they're not registered. But to get the Department of Social Development to take the step to register a home or a creche, alternatively to refuse to register them because they don't comply with certain conditions, is a very, very onerous task. What we find is that the basic administrative system in the Department of Social Development in the Eastern Cape is barely operating. Many times we have to launch court proceedings just to compel people to do their job. If you write a letter asking for reasons for a particular decision, you get no response to your letter. In a particular case, we requested reasons around the cutback of funding for administrative positions for children's homes. And despite the fact that we requested these reasons in writing repeatedly, we had to launch a case in the High Court to compel the Department of Social Development to provide reasons. No sooner had we launched the legal application than the reasons were forthcoming. The third issue is the state-run places of safety. There's one in Port Elizabeth. I think it's the only one in the Eastern Cape at the moment. It is the conditions in that place of safety are absolutely appalling. There's stories of electrical wiring not being attended to, toilets blocked, drains blocked, children not attending school, sewage on the floors, subhuman conditions. The Centre for Child Law managed to intervene and compel the Department of Social Development to take urgent steps to rectify the conditions in the place of safety. We've also dealt with reform schools. We brought a legal case against the Department of Education and the Department of Social Development to compel them to establish a reform school in the Eastern Cape. This building has been ready for 4 years and it is still not staffed. The Department of Education was taken back to court this year to compel them to provide the staff to get the school running. We note that the children's bill provides that the reform schools will be run by the Department of Social Development, and we think that that is a positive development, but the functions of the department need to be very, very clearly specified. There is still no reform school in Eastern Cape, despite all the legal intervention. Previously, the children were taken to a reform school in Mpumalanga, but there was a breakdown in communication between the Department of Education and the Department of Social Development, and neither department could agree on which department was responsible for transporting the children to the school, and so they stayed in Port Elizabeth and didn't actually carry out their sentences. Many of these children were forced to stay in prison instead of a reform school. So those are the experiences which I'm able to share with you around the child and youth care centres, and my input on the bill is that it is very welcome and the amendments are welcome, but that the obligations on the different spheres of government need to be very, very clear. The basic principles of administrative justice need to be built into the bill so that the government departments are aware that they need to take steps within a certain number of days to respond to a request to register, to either refuse or accept the registration, and then to provide funding for the institutions that they register. Because the current situation is that the children's homes do not know from 1 year to the next if they're going to receive funding, that they are burdened with a large number of children that are left orphaned. And unfortunately, it's our experience that despite the fact that it's best for children to be kept close to their communities and in small homes and not brought up in residential care, there's an enormous demand for children's homes. And well-run institutions are being overburdened without the commitment from the Eastern Cape Department of Social Development to assist them with their running, functioning, and funding.
Thank you very much. Obviously, much of what you said relates to our other work, which is exercising oversight on government with regard to the delivery of our services. And I'd urge that in the further particular that regard, that those be furnished to the committee secretary so that we can raise the matter with the minister so that he can make a follow-up with the department and with the relevant provincial government. But we would certainly like, whilst you're still on the floor, to address us on any specific issues relating to the provisions as they are contained in the bill. Do you believe that the
matter of the support to facility, the question of the implementation of registration procedures, etc., that we have raised, are firstly adequately covered in the legislation, such that clear obligations, not on the part of the service providers, but also on the part of administration, who then have to oversee or implement, you know, those administrative procedures, are effectively regulated as the legislation stands. And if not, where are the shortcomings? Do you think that some kind of norms and standards could be set that would obviate the kind of litigious relationship that seems to have evolved in your case? But that's just my question. On that note, I'm going to open your presentation for questions from colleagues. Ms. Sampo, I think you have raised your hand.
Thank you. This takes a bleak picture of the operation of the Department of First Development Security case. And I wonder if her experience of that bleak picture was confined just to the Eastern Cape, or is it her impression that this happens in other First Development departments in the rest of the provinces in the country?
Yes, Ms. Wither.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is a very enlightening presentation which we've just heard. And obviously, SESTM does have to grassroots level experiences. I would just like to find out whether she considers that the government's intention of keeping children, given thousands of orphans that we are getting in, due to the HIV and AIDS and other illnesses, whether there would be sufficient foster care people fostering these children, or do you think that we should now consider going the way of children's homes, children's places of safety? And I have to agree with her very much regarding children being brought to homes and being a financial burden. I have experienced this myself. I would also like to find that she finds that the bureaucracy around children's homes is far too bulky regarding getting them registered, and whether there should be some easier norms and standards to get them registered. And whether, I would just like to get the feeling of her, how we can solve this, because I do really sympathize with her. And if she could really give us some basic input onto what she would suggest we should do. Thank you, Chair.
For that, any Honourable Mokopane Ndule?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning. My apologies for being late. I had a commitment that I couldn't get myself out of before the public hearings were concerned. Having said that, there are just two things that I think the one question, the Honourable, whereby, because I think I missed the last part of your presentation, just as you conclude, where you were saying whether, I just need to get the communal way of raising children versus the children's way. Because you said that there's a demand. And there's a demand, and I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking, how does government keep on doing and removing children from you know? I just as I need you to just go back to that, and maybe I might have missed what you said. But also, I think constantly I could pick up the terminology of obligations versus. So I'm sitting here and I'm saying, some of you, yourself, you said that there are challenges in certain things being done. But also, you said that certain things must not be, you know, must be obligations.
and I'm sitting here and I'm trying to say, okay, if we put certain demands in the legislation, what, you know, your understanding as somebody that's in the field out there. Because I believe that certain things can be resolved quicker rather than imposing every time throwing the law at people's faces. So, but I might, that's just my view. If you could just give me a sense of, let me say, progressive realization versus what is actually yours. I can't get, I'm thinking in Setswana this morning. So I'm struggling with getting the right English.
Obligation as opposed.
Yes. As opposed to
promoting the progressive realization of those objectives. Yeah.
Those are the two things that I need to read.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further takers? Members? Okay. Please proceed and respond to the question.
I'll try and answer the questions in the order in which they were presented to me. I think largely I have in my submissions covered quite a few of the administrative aspects of the bill and where I think there are some shortcomings. And I think largely they are well covered. It's just that in certain instances where there is, I 100% agree with the requirement that all of these homes and institutions and child and youth care centers need to be registered. But what I would like to see is that there are steps that are clearly set out, that if an application is made to get registered, then there needs to be a response within X period of time, either 30 days or 60 days. What currently happens is that these institutions apply to get registration, and they hear nothing. You don't even know if the application has been submitted or received. There's a lack of basic procedural manners in the Department of Social Development. There is an obligation or an understanding that people should deal with their regional offices or their district offices, which is then leading to the MEC's office issue. But often there's a will in the MEC's office to deal with applications and provide funding, but at the district level, there's just a complete lack of willingness of officials to do their job. So where I say that people have applied for registration of creches over a period of 3 years, they've not had a response to that application. And so I would like the procedures.
Arts and culture needs an extra member to elect the chair. Is there an ANC member who wants to volunteer for 1 minute, for 5 minutes and come back? I know this is fascinating, but most members in parliament are in Bizana, so they're having a bit of a challenge there. Okay. What's the name? One Twenty Saint Street, number two. Somebody who has the agility to run. Okay. Please proceed.
So I think that the bill needs to be a little bit clearer on the basic procedural requirements, time frames within which to respond to an application for registration, and then time frames within the decision needs to be taken with a clear proviso that reasons need to be given for any decision that is taken. So if the decision is made to refuse registration, then the person applying for registration needs a clear reason as to why they've been refused their application. And then once an institution is registered, I would like to see an obligation to provide funding. So the filtering process is taken at the registration level. And once it's been recognized that there's a need for that child and youth care center to operate, then there must be some assurance that center will be given the funding. certain level of funding. Because at the moment, even with legislation, there's no assurance from one year to the next whether or not people will get funding for the institution. And then the process of getting funding is extremely onerous. So I don't know if that quite covers your question on the bill and as it stands and the implementation of registration and procedures. Then I don't actually have a clear picture on what's happening in the other provinces. Unfortunately, although we do have offices in the other provinces, they're not dealing with the same kind of work that we're dealing with. I know from my experience dealing with disability grants and old age pensions, the position was pretty deep right across the provinces, and we now have the implementation of the ABT, which I understand is operating fairly well. I mean, the Eastern Cape is historically one of the worst off provinces, and whatever newspaper you read it will agree with that picture, but I don't know what's going on in other provinces. And I must just say that there does appear to be a will at a very senior level in the Department of Social Development to work with us at the district level where we find a complete breakdown in people basically doing their job. Question on whether it's better to keep children in foster care as opposed to children's homes. Unfortunately, I'm the product of an institution. I went to boarding schools and I can't bear institutions. And I don't think it can ever be said that it can be better for a child to be brought up in an institution than in a home. I think more and more people need to be encouraged to look after children in their community. But the problem is that the temporary measure, which is safety fees, it's extremely difficult to get payment of the safety fees, provides a financial burden on the family. To get a foster care order, it takes probably at least 2 years in the Eastern Cape to get a foster order, which would then entitle you to a foster care grant. That is administered through a different agency, and once you've got the order through the magistrate, it's not difficult to collect your grant. Everybody speaks about the problem with social workers, but there are not enough social workers to do the work that is required. Children need, what happens is that children are placed in a place of safety, which is supposed to be a temporary order. These temporary orders keep being extended because there's not sufficient social worker power to do the necessary investigation to make the final placement. So I believe that, yes, there are sufficient, it's possible to care for a large number of children through foster care arrangements. But the process of getting a child fostered and the Department of Social Development's interactions with that process need to be speeded up. Yes, bureaucracy is too bulky. We have a situation where a well-known organization like Child and Family Welfare will apply for a grant because one of the activities that they do is they run a children's home. Finally, the grant gets approved, but then they're told that they have to operate a completely separate bank account. So then they get the money, but before they can get the money, they have to go and open a new bank account, and they have to appoint a new board. Despite the fact that there's no indication that the current system of management is not properly operating. They've got proper accounting systems, they've got a well-established board, their organization's been going on for a long time, but there's completely unreasonable requirements that they now operate a separate system just for that children's home. There's no indication that they're going to get funding next year, so it might just be a once-off thing that they have to go through just to get the children's home grant for this year. I don't know how to solve the problem. I don't know how to get communities to take responsibility for their children. In a small town like Barkley East, there's just one children's home. They're caring for more than 18 children under the age of 5. It's not in anybody's best interest that that happens. It's not what the children's home wants for itself or for its children. But they keep on being brought children saying, please care for this child, it's just a temporary measure. We're going to find a home for the child. Please care for this child, it's just a temporary measure. So they take the child in because they've got nice facilities, they're able to source extra funding, and there's a child in need. The children land up staying there because nobody wants to take them back again. So I'm far more in favor of the immune system looking after children than children's homes. The answer to the question of obligations versus the progressive realization of rights, in the Eastern Cape, the progressive realization of rights doesn't work unless there's a clear obligation on the government department to perform certain functions within a given time period. I don't believe those functions will be performed.
Yeah, I'm worried about the time, but I'll give you a very brief plan to do so.
Thanks very much for the last answer. I still need to get a sense, because I just, especially from practitioners, I mean, writing in an obligation, do you see anything changing? I mean, I'm just sitting here and I'm trying to say, let's take the Eastern Cape. They know this is what they need to do. So I need to be convinced so that if I sit and go through the bill and I have to put a must where there's a may, I must be convinced that one word is going to change that child's life. And at the moment, I just need you to just elaborate. How do you see that practically becoming effective, except that lawyers are just going to make more money and spend half their life in court, taking government to court? And that's what I'm struggling with.
Can I just also indicate that perhaps an indictment on us Parliament, because as I said, much of what you have to say probably relates less to regulation and more to implementation. And this Parliament has a constitutional responsibility to exercise oversight in relation to implementation of national legislation and policy. Perhaps at some point, we may need to actually defend the point and case, and in the company of the officials there, and visit some of these places and see for ourselves what is the extent of the problem, and have an engagement with the officials as to how they hope to resolve the issue. Because certainly, I'm not convinced that about the shortage of money. Certainly when we interacted with Treasury recently, the impression we got was that capacity is more of a challenge than the availability of resources in that found in money. But let's not take it much further than that. I think that if you make your point, you can make your final comment in response to but I think as a committee we definitely have to take up this matter differently. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with the question that taking the obligation say is not necessarily going to solve the problem. That is the, as I said earlier, sometimes I have to go to court just to compel someone to do their job. They know what their job is and they're paid to do that particular job, and all we're doing is asking the court them to do it. So it's not necessarily going to help the situation. I think that the oversight function of the Minister of Social Services is imperative, and that wherever there is a situation where the local authority or the MEC's office is not providing the necessary oversight or doing their job, the oversight function must rest with the Minister of Social Development, and the bill needs to make that clear. And I think that is the best possible remedy.
Prescribed numbers to plan it. And I assume also monitors the implementation of those numbers. The Constitution provides for national legislation to set out a national number. In a sense, that part seems to be covered. The issue really is, let's find a way that things can be implemented without the need for anybody to push anybody else, whether through litigation or other means. But we'll leave it on that note. And thank you very much for your contribution. Useful perspective there. We shall immediately proceed to the next presentation, which is the third presentation from the South African Council of Churches, and they present Reverend Anna Marie Kluke-Dama. The stage is yours. Likewise, if you want me to recognize your face in the future when I meet you in the street, you do well to come and be closer to me. Can we suggest that any member who's short of any submission, they indicate, and that we can administratively make sure that everybody has their Okay, we'll ask the secretary to assist in finding, solving that particular problem. Okay, shall we proceed in the meantime, Reverend?
Good morning, Chair. Greetings from the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, Ms. Eddie McHugh, who says a warm word of gratitude for requesting us to make this presentation, this submission. Mr. McHugh is at present in the United States attending a two-week-long practice session on the implementation of the Decade to Overcome Violence. I think it's significant to understand that out of 300 churches worldwide, the South African Council of Churches was singled out and asked to participate in that event over 2 weeks because the world in religious and church terms is focusing on South Africa and what's happening in South Africa. And so greetings from that context as the church struggles to find the means of promoting a world of dignity, of peace, and free from violence in what is the decade to overcome violence right now. And I think that's significant as he brings greetings and an apology for being unable to be here, sir. Secondly, to indicate, and I think we've been through the exercise many times before, that the South African Council of Churches is a representative of some 26 denominations in this country, totaling an amount of 15 to 16 million people, a significant amount. And we raise that in the essence that the Council of Churches, which has just held its national conference 1 month ago, has underwritten and supported, which needs to repeat here, this current presentation, the support for the Children's Act in 2004, as well as the submission that is to be made in the Children's Amendment Bill. I then present you, sir, the Reverend Anna Marie Kluke-Dama from the South African Council of Churches in the Western Cape, who is a member of the executive here, sir, and the General Secretary has asked, particularly that she speak to the Council of Churches submission, which will be made. Could I just say that we are delighted, sir, that South Africa seems to be moving a step closer towards concluding this epic journey in trying to find appropriate legislation for particularly the care and protection of South Africa's most vulnerable children. And we understand that we are engaged in this exercise, and we are delighted that it seems we are moving, maybe inching, but certainly moving towards the conclusion of a piece of legislation which we believe will have and should have the desired impact, particularly the lives of millions of the citizens who make up the future of this nature. So we affirm again our support for the care and compassion that is shown through the progressive legislation that's been produced so far, sir, for the poor and vulnerable and destitute children who rely not simply, who rely simply on the nation's care for their respect, for their dignity, for their protection, and ultimately for the survival to be the kind of nation we want to be and to show the world we are. And I hand over to Reverend Kruger Diamond to take us through the submission from the Council of Churches.
Morning. Thank you very much. I must say that it's been a very, very long time since I've heard my heart beat in my throat. I'm so nervous, but I'm very, very glad to be here. Thank you. I'll take you through the chapter 5, the partial care, and chapter 6, early childhood development. Faith-based communities and many others use their physical and human resources, such as their premises and dedicated people, to enhance the upbringing, development, and care for children on a daily basis. Many do so for little or no reward under dire circumstances. The FECC affirms the idea that service and program delivery to the community will be enhanced by more coordinated participation between government departments. We recommend that such coordination include the resources organized at local level by the many civic and faith communities. To this end, we recognize the need for the setting of norms and standards, as well as for procedures of registration for partial care facilities. Unless procedures for registration are efficiently coordinated and integrated into interdepartmental responsibility, a cumbersome bureaucracy may result in community involvement in partial care facilities being a disincentive rather than invitation to dedicated and gifted voluntary workers. The rationale for separating chapters 5 and 6 appears unclear. There is a close link between partial care and the program ECD. Women, mothers, and grandmothers of the churches indeed very often hold families and extended families, play significant roles of caring for and raising children under therefore in their early human and social development. We support the holistic view of development in the definition of section 91.1. In line with the international statutes for the rights of the child, however, we point out that the terminus ad quem for ECD is age 8. In light of the developmental impediments created and furthered by the legacies of apartheid, disease and disability, we call for the ECD program and services to be provided to age 9, section 91.1 and 91.2b. We also support the call by Disabled Children's Action Group to take into account not only the child's chronological age, but also his or her developmental stage, since many children with disability will come late into the ECD. We affirm the inclusion of a compulsory national strategy in the departmental strategy, including special needs such as disability and chronic illness. Registration needs broader coordination as well as simplification. The FECC welcomes legislation for the provision of ECD programs at provincial level, but recommends that the MEC responsible be obligated to fund the provision of such programs. To read, the MEC for social development of a province must and delete the may in that section 93.1. This recommendation is to apply to all instances in the bill where financial provision for services to be rendered with regard as optional, and in brackets, may. In order to ensure that the legislation provides ultimately for an effective and integrated service for ECD, PC, and prevention and early intervention, we suggest either the creation of linkages with these sections of the bill or condensing these chapters into one comprehensive chapter. Chapter 8 on the prevention and early intervention. This section aims at the prevention of neglect, abuse, or inadequate supervision of children that may lead to breakdown of relationships and family structure which may hinder the provision of the child's needs. It also aims at preventing recurring problems in the family environment that may adversely affect the child's development. Should the child come into conflict with the law, this section aims at diverting him or her away from the criminal justice system and the child and youth care system. The provisions aim at the preservation of the child's family structure and avoidance of removal from the family environment, as well as the development of parenting skills by parents and or caregivers in order to safeguard the well-being and best interest of the child. We affirm this paradigm shift from the earlier statutory legal criminal approach to a social and human developmental model. This transition requires all-around capacity development, training, and a commensurate provision of resources for it to work effectively. A key point for the identification of and response to child vulnerability, like the provision of care support and or professional referral, is at the school. We repeat that some form of intersectoral mechanism enforcing the cooperation of the Departments of Education and Social Development is crucial to realization, effective delivery, and success of this developmental approach. This approach should be widened to acknowledge, for instance, the already active work performed by many civil society organizations and faith communities, especially church-based organizations. We recognize, too, that municipalities, even though the employment of social work professionals may not fall into their sphere of competencies, have an obligation to cooperate with the other spheres of government to ensure the delivery of these services. Under Children with Disability, Clause 11 of the Children's Act recognizes the state's obligation to provide care and protection for children with disabilities. The SECC underlines and supports, among other areas of concern and opportunity within the bill, as indicated by the Disabled Children's Action Group. Legislation is required at the local level to ensure that children with disabilities receive universal access to services. Prevention services and programs include the prevention of disabilities through the provision of poverty eradication services, thereby aiming at the elimination and prevention of diseases and disabilities associated with chronic poverty, example, the fetal alcohol syndrome. Appropriate training and capacity building within the ECD, child care work and police sectors on being equipped and sensitive to a range of skills required to communicate and interact with children with disabilities. Under the HIV and AIDS foster care and cluster foster care, due to the inequity between the amount of foster care grants and the child support grant, families are using foster care as a poverty alleviation measure. Children and caregivers needing income support become locked into a system of expensive child protection. The government needs to distinguish between social services and protection services and poverty alleviation. Not all orphans are children in need of care and protection. The foster care grant should be reserved for children in need of care and protection and who have been placed in foster care by court. A universal CSG, a child support grant, something like a guaranteed income extended to age 18, should be used to support relatives looking after children. Kinship care should not be administered by social workers, but by other social service professionals, such as child and youth care workers. There needs to be a range of options for orphans and vulnerable children that enable them to be dealt with outside of the court system and social work services. Poverty alleviation needs to be de-linked from the court system. Court-ordered kinship care is still relevant for children who have had to be removed from home while a family member has taken responsibility for their child. The SECC supports the call to stop the use of SCG as a poverty alleviation mechanism. The exploration of formally bringing together extended families for support of orphans and vulnerable children in the spirit of Ubuntu or Boto is worth exploring. One such model, cluster foster care, proposed by the National Association of Child and Youth Care Workers, appears to be a viable option. The foster care system is facing redundancy due to increased numbers of children in the care of relatives. The Department of Social Development reported that the numbers of children in foster care had by May this year increased by 700% since April 2000. As a result, children in need of care and protection are unable to be dealt with by the protection services and social workers. In the context of South Africa's HIV and AIDS pandemic, where poverty is a major contributory factor, a coordinated thrust of social services, social security, and social assistance is required to work together in a well-coordinated manner if a measure of poverty eradication is to be achieved. One solution frequently raised by the SACC, the labor movement and other civil society organizations would be to take seriously the extension of the child support grant to age 18, non-means tested and extended as the first step of a universal income grant. Discipline of children. The SACC welcomes section 139 because it seeks to advance a culture of dignity, respect and equity of relations within which our children may be able to flourish as human beings. The Department of Social Development is warmly commended for fostering legislation that seeks to recognize children's rights as human rights. Children are human beings too, through the proposal to prohibit corporal punishment as well, abolish the common law defense of reasonable chastisement. Furthermore, the SACC welcomes the ongoing support for the role of parental responsibilities by the state as it makes available programs on positive discipline and parenting in line with the constitutional values of human dignity, respect, and equity. We welcome to the prospect that outcomes of such programs are likely to initiate an environment of trust rather than fear, respect rather than control, and thereby provide for a culture that contributes to order through the respect, peace, building, and nonviolence. We support this clause because we believe it will contribute positively and significantly to turning the cycles of reported violence, abuse, and neglect against children in the long term. We attach a frequently asked question on religion, positive discipline, and the abolition of corporal punishment. In the Christian context, there are differing approaches and interpretations to texts as they may refer to violence in the past. If there is, then no one interpretation agreed to by all Christians. There is not an agreed position which may be termed Christian or religious. The point here is that it is not the task of the legislature to decide on or arbitrate between contending sides of scriptural interpretation. The matter of punishment as it is faced by the policymakers is a question of human rights abuse when practiced in whatever form. The Church therefore has a duty to the public and the citizens of South Africa to encourage it in legislation that seeks the best constitutional value. Once again, Ubuntu, even if the re-imaging of these values challenges as the traditions and thought of the religious establishment. And once again, the department is to be commended. Child aided households, the SACC welcomes the provision of a mentorship scheme for the care and material support of children living in child aided households. The SACC has no hard and fast opinion about whether the recognized age limit of a child heading a household should be 15 or 16. The SACC is concerned that the requirement for the provincial Department of Social Development to recognize a child-headed household and therefore for them to receive assistance in social work investigation. That is a social work investigation. The SACC calls for the recognition of Section 150.2 of the Children's Act that all children living in a child-headed household be treated as children in need of care and protection, and that a mentor be appointed during the investigation. We suggest that abandoned children be included in the definition of child-headed households. Child and Youth Care Centers. The SACC commends the Department for the provision of these centers whose services include a range of treatment and therapy to children who are challenged with a need for care and protection. We also welcome the provision of shelters. And the children on the street, while we welcome the provision of shelters, we remain concerned that the delegation of responsibility to municipalities for their registration might not happen in the spirit of intersectoral cooperation with provincial government. We affirm, however, the importance of municipalities' responsibility for delivering on care and protection of children at these shelters. In conclusion, the SACC has worked with civil society in general and with the Children's Bill Working Group, in particular over the past years. We know that the Department of Social Development, and particularly Minister Skweyiya, voices our concern for children when he says that children are everyone's business. We are together in the concern that both government and civil society look forward to a comprehensive form of legislation that will provide for an environment conducive to the well-being, development, and flourishing of children, distinct from what we had witnessed under apartheid. For these reasons, we make the call in this application trusting that the best foundation for legislation over the next decade that seeks to place children in need of special care and protection.
Thank you very much. Secondly, the complimentary comments are a blessing, and hopefully they'll set the case for what is become of the way forward. The presentation took up much of the time allocated, so there will be very little time left for interaction. Let me also indicate I'm checking because 11 o'clock is supposed to be a tea break. The state of readiness of the tea. Is it ready? Oh, okay. So what we will do is we'll briefly interact with this presentation, break for tea for a very short period of time. It's 10 minutes allocated. If we can do it shorter, even be better. Ms. Duffy?
Thank you. Thank you to the presenters. I know we're short of time, but a lot of your presentation is very clear, and I won't comment on most of it, so I'll go straight to the part of discipline of children, just to get some clarity there. Basically, welcoming the support for the role of parents and the programs that are envisioned, which is awesome. And I would like to ask, would you not see these programs having the same beneficial results without having to tamper with reasonable society? Because obviously that hasn't been attempted yet, and I kind of sense that would be a very positive way to go. The point here is not that the state is tasked, it's not the legislature's task to decide or attribute or arbitrate between contending sides of scriptural interpretation. And I think that's really a very important point to make. But there, you know, and we say exactly, is it not reasonable then to not outlaw those parents who are convicted in terms of parental discipline of their children? For example, what I'd like to ask, and this would be important, if you look at Section 139 and you look at 2, no child may be subjected to, and I want to ask, if the word unreasonable was put in there, no child may be subjected to unreasonable corporal punishment or punished in a cruel, inhumane, or degrading way, would that so seriously alter what you're actually saying here in your submission? Obviously, 3 would then be dropped, and 4 would be no person may administer unreasonable corporal punishment to a child or subject the child to any form of cruel, inhumane, or degrading punishment at a child or a youth care center, et cetera, et cetera. So especially in view of the fact that you pointed out so accurately that it's not the legislature's job to arbitrate between contending sides of a scriptural argument, and this, and what is proposed here would actually outlaw a very large number of people who understand their responsibility in terms of their faith to be administering a very reasonable parental discipline.
Yes. From my side, I just wanted to ask the question. You obviously work very closely with communities. You work within the community. And you are very familiar with the what you actually refer to as the traditional paraphrasing perspective on some of the issues. Certainly, when we did hearings out in the rural areas, the responses were very clear to this legislation. People are accustomed to doing things in a particular way. So naturally, there would be a resistance for anything that calls upon them to deviate from the way they are used to doing things. How do you see this gap being bridged between the need to advance, promote a culture of human rights in which there's respect for the dignity, integrity of the child, as stated in the Constitution on the one hand, and, you know, a practice. Look, I refuse the argument that it's explicitly African culture to have this. People talk of Europe, certain practice or certain suggestions being Eurocentric in this legislation. And I always ask the question, which Europe are we talking about, the new or the old Europe? Because if you look at the old Europe, certainly the common law itself speaks for itself. It legalized corporal punishment, so, you know, and it's a European system. So. But just in terms of bridging the gap between where people are at and where this legislation is trying to take us to, in my opinion, how do you propose as the check which works in the community to bridge that gap?
Thank you. Those are the two questions to deal with, check.
And it will have shorter your time.
So I just respond to the second question first, and I think there are three answers to your second question, and they are educate. And it's about the churches that have adopted the importance of teaching and of educating about the culture of human rights. And I think that goes not just within the cultural tradition that we've inherited and that we are trying to create within South Africa, but it goes for our own religious traditions, and we speak for the churches ourselves. If we contend with that there are very often differing interpretations of how we've done things in the past and what human rights culture expects of us to do. And there's a humbling response, I think, within the churches saying is that we need to, part of it, understand that where human rights culture may have clashed or may be clashing with some of the traditional practices or some of the religious practices which have been our culture, we need to ask questions in terms of how we advance 21st century human dignity and respect amongst our constituencies and amongst our sectors. And I think I agree entirely, sir, is that what we very often hear in the rural traditional provincial hearings, from what I gathered from my colleagues, has raised the debate as to some of the promoted understandings of what is traditional, but has really been traditional that's been clouded by the legacies of colonialism and apartheid past. And so we have to learn to unlearn some of those to capture the essences of what are the human values of culture, of African culture, but incorporated into that word of Ubuntu support that's been used by the Reverend Peter Diamond so frequently. So it's about learning our past, learning about what the human rights culture demands for us and where it needs to transform current past practices, is to be prepared to teach, to learn, and to educate our constituency, certainly to bridge the gap between what is reality and what is the expected values and vision of our constitution. So that's hopefully a short indication of where the churches are at, I think, in terms of dealing with current practices inherited from traditional parts and what is it being expected of us within the constitution and the international acceptable rights for human practice currently. In the same way, Madam Dudley, I'd like to just say that I think we've struggled very much within the churches dealing with the proposal of what we accept within the Children's Amendment, but we've come a long way with the Children's Act and Bill. We've given our full support, as you would know, in 2005 to the Children's Act and to the provision of a full clause of rights of the children. One of those is the explicit living up of the protection of the children's rights of bodily integrity and to be free from bodily harm and cruel and degrading punishment. So again, a rights issue that the churches have grappled and struggled with. In terms of the legal interpretation of reasonable chastisement, The churches have been clear, at least from the SACC side, is that it is not sure what to expect as to what reasonable may be, or unreasonable in the vague sense. What is unreasonable chastisement, and what is reasonable chastisement? Where does one draw the line between such chastisement, which very often is confused with an emotional response in the time possibly of anger, and the legal complaints of assault for a given sex? So that's that dark gray area that the churches have chosen to speak to, knowing that this may well create something of a choice. But it's been important to say is that rather than promote within the legislature any further confusion or choice of interpretation of the religious side for or against corporal punishment, we have chosen the line to say that we supported the Children's Act in terms of the human rights principles, in particular the principle of protection from degrading, harmful, and cruel punishment, and call on the legislature to explore and to implement that particular piece of human rights legislature for children. And I think we miss the point very often that children are human beings too. We would not advocate, certainly, wouldn't there, the two of us disagree, man, and I give you a punch, and you give me a punch. It would not be an appropriate way to deal with it within, neither within Parliament nor within society. Why should it be appropriate? Because of an age difference. And I think the church has been clear that in terms of the human rights capacity of children, being human beings, it's the appropriate position to put to request portfolio committee and Department of Social Development to give serious attention to the implementation of human rights across the board for children.
Maybe, yes, please.
I think that's very important that you pointed out the situation of a punch, and this is why the proposal has been put forward in terms of, because obviously loving, correcting discipline has nothing to do with punching or inhumane, cruel, or degrading punishment or whatever. So because of that, is it not better to separate those things, because we do need to deal with any cruel, inhumane, and degrading behavior. But to throw loving parental discipline into that category, now the way it has been suggested here is that we could differentiate things if we actually define what that parental discipline would and could be. It certainly would not include punching. And I mean, it's here in some of these things, and I don't want to take the time, or we could read it now. Of course, on the other hand as well, it was interesting to hear your comments, and just with the reasonable chastisement, because obviously the word reasonable is such a well-known legal term, and it's so understood in terms of the court, that there's such a strong sense that has not been, that the legislation that exists has actually not been applied, and that's why, because the courts are not confused about the issue of reasonable. But just to hear your quick comment in terms of what about us separating that? Yes, and there may be a time when parents are actually being abused as inhumane and cruel. However, that is not parental corporal punishment. That is not what is meant by this thing, and we need to divide it out. In fact, even the word corporal punishment are almost horrific to any parent who's talking about loving parental discipline. So is there not a way that we can separate these two issues and not have the contentious issues that we're facing at this moment?
Maybe corporal punishment is what it is, and it can be anything else. But I'll give you an opportunity to respond, yeah?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. I think, once again, the punch is simply a symbolic expression of one form of punishment. And that cuts across the board as to whether it is an open-handed smack or a back-handed smack, or whether it's a punch, or whether it's a smack with a paddle spoon. It doesn't matter. It's a symbolic act of using force in one way or another. That's important that the churches have expressed their mind on. It's the very symbolic way of how we deal with conflict, and that portrays the way within the child, what does the child learn from that act? That's important. And I think I've spoken about education earlier, and I think it's fundamentally important for us to see that whether we talk about a punch, and that's just the problem, or whether an open-handed smack or a slap on the backside, or wherever it may be, corporal punishment is corporal punishment. It's the act that's symbolic that shows that. The response of the Council of Churches, and I think that what either said, I think the other part that's not being seen is that, again, maybe we need to underline that this piece of legislation is particularly about the care and protection of especially vulnerable children, of children who may not be in the home and the family that fortunate children are in. I think we need to see it and remember it in that context, and I think the legislation needs to be, or the part needs to be affirmed for speaking about promotion of positive discipline within this context of discipline, that punishment is not necessarily seen synonymously with discipline, and that discipline is promoted in this piece of legislation as an option for and as a way for helping our children and society deal with conflict in the kind of human rights and in the kind of the 21st century human rights culture that we want to see not only be implemented now but developing in the future. And I think it's within that sense that the Council of Churches has supported that piece of legislation within, or that proposal within the current legislature. I think if I could just take the Honourable's suggestion further, I think we've also said very clearly that there needs to be a clear intersectoral mechanism. I would think in this sense, this piece of legislation would need to stretch around the Department of Justice with, for argument's sake, the Child Justice Bill, and in terms of what would happen in family court, family conferencing, for argument's sake, as an example in terms of how conflict can be dealt with and should be dealt with within a humane society, within a society that practices human rights. So I think the issue of not removing, but I think certainly finding cross-referencing and finding its reference to other parts of legislation, other practices within government is important. So I think that's where the value of supporting the issue of positive discipline and the abolition of corporal punishment would come in, not in its removal, but in its cross-referencing to various other pieces of legislation that might similarly deal with the life and rights of children in our nation.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take it up to that point. I can just say that earlier I mentioned the old church, the new, and I'm impressed to see the new church emerging out of the old. I must say, I myself went to Catholic school for 12 full years, and corporal punishment there was the order of the day. And we used to tease the system with the hope that we would receive corporal punishment as a form of defiance. And the more you could take more lashes without crying, the more you end your point within amongst your peers. So it's and I'm told that it's built the character that I am today. But we'll take this matter further. But I just wanted to say that perhaps we must start talking as Africans about the old Africa and the new Africa, and start looking at whether some of the cultural values that we so dearly uphold should not actually reflect the evolution and the development of society that has occurred. On that note, I'm going to ask that we pause for a very brief time, take the tea while before it gets too cold, and then as soon as possible, resume our conversation. George Rapp. Okay, just put them there at the center, and anybody who wishes to get a copy, they will do so. Okay, the stage is yours. It's your opportunity to shine.
Thank you, Chairperson. I represent...
Let me just indicate, we do not have a whip allocated yet, so I will struggle a bit to keep discipline for the time being, but hopefully soon we'll have a whip who will whip us all into order. But please proceed.
Thank you. Chairperson, I represent Life Enrichment Ministries, which is a predominantly counseling and teaching ministry in the Johannesburg area, founded by Reverend Andrew George, who's an ordained Baptist minister. The ministry focuses in particular on counseling in respect of parenting and child issues, and Reverend George has made a particular study in this regard, in particular about corporal punishment. He has written a book about corporal punishment and the effects of that with regard to ADD. Why I'm saying all this is just to explain to you that it's not, our representation is not just based on hearsay or hysterical reaction or anything like that. It is based on a well-founded study in regard to the parenting issues, and in particular with regard to the biblical issues flowing from it. The ministry has the endorsement of two denominations in South Africa. The Baptist Union of South Africa has endorsed our written submission, as has the Church of England in South Africa. We also have the endorsement of 17 individual churches, representing in the 17 individual churches about 3,350 individuals. So we speak on behalf of those individuals and on behalf of two denominations in the country. I think it's important for us to stress that those individuals and those two denominations have a common denominator, and that is that we believe in the supremacy of the Scripture, of the Bible, in all matters referring to life and to moral issues. We recognize, obviously, that the Bible is not a textbook on science or anything, but as far as morals are concerned, we believe that it is the ultimate word, and we refer there to 2 Peter 3, His divine power has given us everything for life and godliness. It has been interesting for me to listen to the debates that have preceded about what is reasonable and what is not reasonable, and I hope to show to the members today that what is reasonable is very clearly set out in the Bible. Chairperson, our written submission deals to a large extent with the constitutional issues relating to the bill. I should say that our objection, we do have an objection against the bill, but our objection is limited to Section 139. The amendments relating to corporal punishment in the home, and it's very narrowly focused on that. We do not intend to deal with any other aspects of the bill. The written submission deals with the issues of constitutionality of the changes, etc. I'm not going to expand on that. I'm going to stay with what we've written there. I'm quite happy to take questions about that aspect afterwards, but that's not the main thrust of my oral submission. The main thrust of my oral submission is on the spiritual basis. It has been very concerning to me to listen to the debates that have gone on before, to hear that we propound on moral and biblical issues, and not once have we referred to the Bible. every single argument that we've made, that has been made so far, has been made from the vantage point of the view of man. Every single argument has been based on human dignity, human rights, etc. It is our constituency's attitude that human rights flow from a recognition of the sovereignty and the supremacy of God, the God of the Bible. And it is from that viewpoint that we will approach this. And I would ask the honorable members then to turn with me to page 8 of our written submission. And I will go through it very quickly. Just on page 8.6112, I'm going to refer you to certain commandments in the Bible that deal with punishment and discipline in general. 611 deals with the specific obligation and the mandate for Christian parents to obey God and to discipline them in the upbringing of their children. 6112, Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 to 7. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your heart. Impress them on your children. Talk to them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. In other words, in your entire life, apply discipline. 6113, Ephesians 6, verse 4. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, and my emphasis there, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. If we turn to page 9, 6116, Hebrews 12, verses 8 to 9, if you are not disciplined and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. If I may just skip back, we apologize for that. Just 6114, Proverbs 19, verse 8. Discipline your son, for in that there is hope. Do not be a willing party to his death. Proverbs 29:17. Discipline your son, and he will give you peace. He will bring you delight to your soul. I wish to emphasize the thinking, the rationale behind those verses. It is to say that discipline your children in a larger context, not in a context of just getting them to obey your life, your laws or your rules in this life, but it is with a larger relationship issue behind it, the relationship focus, the relationship firstly with the parents, because as I will hope to show later, the parents stand on earth as the representative of God. And it is through the parents that the child learns his relationship with God. And it is in that context that the Bible requires us to discipline our children so that they will understand the issue of submissiveness before God. Because if we don't, ultimately that will lead to their death. And we all die. That's not talking about physical death. That's talking about spiritual eternal death. And that is the Christian's mandate on earth. 6.1.2, the biblical requirement for corporal punishment, and I refer to corporal punishment specifically. Proverbs 13, verse 24, that's 6.1.2.1, he who spares the rod hates his son. Proverbs 23, 13 to 14, do not withhold discipline for your child. If you punish him with a rod, he will not die. Again, the principle of eternal death. Proverbs 22:15, folly is bound up the heart of the child, but the rod of discipline will drive him far from it. Proverbs 29:15, the rod of correction imparts wisdom. Chairperson, it's very clear. It's a rod we're talking about. It's not talking to somebody. It's not trying to teach him because he doesn't know enough or anything like that. It is trying to teach him something through the rod. But 6.1.3 on page 10. The biblical portions that prevent reactivity, abuse, and brutality. Ephesians 6, verse 4a. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. James 1, verse 20. For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires, and so forth. And I submit to you, sir, that these verses create the framework of reasonableness that is there. Discipline with a rod is necessary, and I will come to that, but do not do so in a manner that exasperates or, well, a moodle was the mark. So, we see the that the Christian faith not only recognizes, and I have heard the representation before, and I do appreciate the honesty of the presenter saying that not all Christians agree with that. We would not agree with their interpretation of the Bible. We do believe that the Bible teaches that the Christian faith not only recognizes, but commands the use of lethal corporal punishment in the upbringing of a child, that that should include corporal punishment, but it should be done in a reasonable manner which does not exasperate the child. Good question. This brings us to a very important aspect of our presentation, in the sense that it places this bill, if this bill passes with the amendments to Section 139 as they stand at the moment, it would place the Christians who think, who share our ethos, directly in contravention of a law. It would actually make criminals of us for daring to discipline our children in accordance with what we understand biblical norms would be. I refer you there, it will leave the Christian as this bill is accepted in this format with an absolute and strenuous choice between obeying a law of the land and following their course conscience. I'm using the words of Justice Sachs in the Christian education case. Now, we talk about alternatives, and I submit to you, sir, that there are no alternatives. Christian discipline is a spectrum. It starts with explaining teaching. Certainly that must be there, with teaching the basics of moral life. It starts with, it flows from there to slightly further discipline, etc. But ultimately, if there is a rebellious and defiant attitude in the child, then the Bible suggests, or not suggests, that's very important, I must say, that the Bible states that you are to use the rod. And that is to bring the child into focus with the principle that his rebellion against his earthly parents is not rebellion just against an earthly parent, it's a rebellion against God, ultimately. All authority has been given by God, Romans 13. Everyone, so your authority has been given by God. Our legislature, their authority has been given by God. Not one of them sits here because they belong to a particular party or because they are bright or anything like that. They exercise a godly mandate. They exercise a godly stewardship. And it is to bring children into that focus, to teach them acceptance of authority that the Bible prescribes the use of the rod. If I may just ask the honourable members to turn to section C, and to see that's the one with the red tag. And I'm just going to read this very quickly. The biblical use and the necessity of corporal punishment. The discipline of children is a process that includes a composite package of facets such as relationship, nurture, instruction, correction, guidance, positive reinforcement, and punishment. As it seems from the above, one tool of the package is discipline and punishment. Again, one tool of punishment is what secular terms would be referred to as corporal punishment. I'm going to skip to the fifth paragraph there, but the biblically defined offenses requiring hiding are the most serious offense a child can commit. We speak here of an expression of the child of an attitude of arrogance, defiance of a parent and parental authority, which is then manifested in a deliberate rebellious behavior. The reason why biblically this is seen to be so serious, that parents are put here by God with a delegated authority from him to represent himself and his authority before their children, which we have blessed. Arrogant defiance and deliberate rebellion expressed towards the parent, therefore, is a direct reference to the person and authority of God represented by the parent. And so forth. I would urge the members just to read the rest of that section. So, Jefferson, if we are put in a position where we have to choose, we have to reply with the words of the Apostle Peter, we must obey God rather than man. I suppose that is the stark choice to which the legislature would put us if they decide to go through with it. And then a very, very important aspect that I wish to bring out is that our constituency objects to the attitude that seems to prevail nowadays, that says, well, the Bible teaches some things which doesn't quite accord with what our modern thinking on human dignity, etc., accords, and therefore that must be wrong. The Bible teaches that you must use corporal punishment, which means that God instructs us to use destructive methods or to bring about that. That is nothing short of blasphemy. And it is something that that would offend the constituency that I stand for very, very deeply. We see that as an affront to the Holy God, and it offends us very, very deeply. Chairperson, just very quickly going on to the legal aspects. Corporal punishment is a specific issue. And I wish the members to listen to hear this very carefully. There is a much bigger emphasis here. There's a much bigger issue. This is the first time that the legislature is trying to enter into the arena of parenting. And I'm going to use, well, maybe I shouldn't use the word. It is the first time that there is a deliberate attempt by the legislature to instruct people of a particular faith. Well, it's a Christian faith. I know there was the Jaffa case with the Presbyterians, etc. But as far as the Christians are concerned, this is the first time that there is a deliberate requirement for us to do something that goes against our conscience. It's a direct attack on the freedom of religion. It is the first time. This might be a momentous time in the history of our country, because it is the first time that the legislature is getting to the point where they are deliberately requiring people to refrain from doing something which they regard as a command of God. So the
can we record you on that one?
Please do. I wish you would.
I'm going to list a number of other pieces of legislation which have provoked particular sentiments.
Sure.
And I'm glad that you
Sir, let me say to you that legislation regarding homosexuality offends the Christian, but the Christian is not enforced by law to partake in homosexuality. Legislation as far as abortion offends the Christian, but we are not forced to take part of it. Here is the first time that we are being said that there is something that you believe in that you may not do. That is an affront to the citizens of this country. We have a constitutional right, and I think it is a very sad day that I have to sit here and come and argue our constitutional right and to say to the legislator, you are trying to take away our rights. You are, the legislator is supposed to be taking these aspects into account before accepting legislation like this. And it is a sad day that I have to stand here. Sir, I refer you to submission paragraph 9.1. Freedom of religion includes the right, A, to have a belief, to express the belief publicly, and to manifest that belief by worship and practice, teaching and dissemination.
Sorry, sir. I just wanted to follow. I'm not sure. On your submission,
if you allow me. At the moment, I'm just reading from paragraph 9.1 of the submission.
9.1.
That's correct. Point 9.1
of which document? The
of the main document.
This one, the top one.
No, the thicker one.
The after the red one.
That's correct. That is on page 26 of the main document.
Okay.
Can I that says that we are entitled to actively practice our religion, and this bill would say that we are not to do so. The bill is setting a precedent. The foundation that the state is giving to this precedent is because the state is basing its the thinking behind the bill seems to be one based on secular humanism that says man is the criterion. We reject that. God is the criterion. The Bible is the criterion. the thinking that says man is the criterion is a system of belief. Whether we express that in religious terms or not, it remains a system of belief. The Constitution of this Court specifically states that the court of the state is not allowed to favor one system of belief above that of another. By doing this, the state is favoring secular humanism above what we believe Christian principles to be. So, the people could say to us, a previous representative has said that there is no clear understanding what the biblical teachings on this are. I will grant him that. But I will say to you, that is unimportant. It's not here, I'm not here to try to persuade you that he is right and I am wrong. I'm saying to you that we have a constituency that believes X, Y, Z, and the state is compelled to give credence to what we are saying. But it's not for the state. I really appreciated that of the previous speaker. But he said it's not for the state to decide what the interpretation of the Bible is. The fact remains that there are people who feel the way that we do, believe it the way that we do. In closing, I just want to say that the corporal punishment that everybody seems to be so upset about, it's not the corporal punishment of the Bible. We are just as opposed to abuse. We are just as opposed to torture. We are just as opposed to any indignity being placed on any person. And we recognize that children are persons. Children are persons. But we are saying that if corporal punishment is administered within the context of the biblical direction, it is not an indignity on that child. It is in fact a element that could lead to that child being a useful citizen, somebody who obeys authority, which I think is something we desperately need in this country, and secondly, somebody who will one day, hopefully, find that he stands before God and is not faced with eternal salvation. Conclusion, our suggestion of the wording of the amendment, we are saying a person who has care of the child, including a person who has parental responsibilities and rights in respect of the child, must respect, promote, and protect the child's rights to physical, psychological integrity, that we agree with. We are suggesting that section 139 be changed to say no child may be punished in a cruel, inhuman, or degrading way, which is fitting perfectly with the Constitution. Number three.
And I warn you that you have almost exhausted the full time for both presentation and engagement.
Certainly, sir. Thank you. And number three, any legislation, any rule of common customary authorizing corporal punishment, that be excluded, that in line with the Williams case, and that for no person may have a child care, youth care center, administer corporal punishment. We don't have a problem with that. Corporal punishment in the court, we don't have a problem. Corporal punishment in institutions, we don't have a problem. Corporal punishment in the home, we have a major problem. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation. Let me warn presenters that when you take up the entire float with your presentation, you deprive yourself of the opportunity of having an interaction with the court, which could be your advantage. But on that note, I'm going to open the presentation for questions. Members, I notice Honourable Bukobani Zulu. Please proceed.
I'm not sure because I tried to. It looks like your presenters have a problem with the way corporate. I would like you to, because I don't understand. I'm a Christian, raised in a Christian family, and I'm like sitting here and I'm shocked, very shocked. And what shocked me is that the first question that I'm struggling with is if you could answer for me why do you think the state has to intervene? If there is this Christian belief and, the way you put it, and why in your own view and in your constituency do you
think there was a need for that? Because I need to understand so that if we do conclude the bill, we do take what you submit. Because at the moment, I can feel the sympathy and the expressions and the what the constituents say. But I'm trying to say, did they engage with why the state has to intervene? That's the best thing that I need, in your understanding why. Because if everything was happening in the ideal way, I don't think that any given state, there will be an opportunity for the state to intervene. The second aspect that I need you to talk to is, why do you have a problem with corporate? Because surely, the things that are happening to children at this day and age, if you read Revelation, it did say those that, you know, these are some of the things that would happen. And we have a responsibility to respond to them. Much as I said that in any event, I am struggling with why in the home, because it's very rare, it happens, not always, that children are abused in places of safety. They are now running from their own homes. That is where the actual abuse is happening. That is where the actual corporal punishment is very specific. That is where the whole cruelty is happening. And that is where the most horrific abuse against children are happening, in the home. And now you say that in terms of Christians, this is wrong. We should not now step in and protect children in their own homes with parents that were meant to protect them, who are not doing that. I need, maybe if you can't exhaust because of time, I would need that enlightenment. Because I need to be convinced in my head. If for whatever reason I'm going to vote for that to be removed, it's not going to be only emotional, or it has to be, I need to balance that. Because homes are the worst of places today for children to grow up in, and that's the end. And we congratulate those families that have been keeping it together, and this bill is just there to support them to do it better. But the truth is, it is not happening. And the question I'm sitting here as a Christian is, where were the Christians?
Honorable Bukhopani is saying that certain homes, they, because I think we do also have very good examples of good child abuse. Let's get the Honorable Stanford and then it's the Honorable Gumede.
Thank you, Chair. I must agree with the previous speaker about, as far as I'm aware, I might be wrong, actually, but the majority of officials on school have done a close test in the home. And while I appreciate the presenter's point of view, which is actually the corporate punishment where we are, the home is probably the least monitored place where such a thing can take place. And we're talking about participants here, and I think all of us would agree with statements that probably a lot of the problems that are being sitting in that are happening in our today are a result of a lack of discipline. And I don't think that the bill has any problem with imposing discipline at all. The problem is around corporal punishment. And it's all well to say that there is reasonable corporal punishment taking place in a loving parental relationship, but I'm not quite sure that all parents have got the same definition of that in mind. And my biggest problem with all of this is the situation of violence in our society, which we read about all the time. And I really don't believe that fighting violence on a particular child is teaching me that that is the right way to actually solve an argument or a disagreement, particularly within the home. Because if that form of violence that is used to solve the problem is then perpetuated in further relationships and further in society as a whole. And, I'd also like to ask the presenter, this form of corporal punishment that is being advanced by biblical arguments, and I'm afraid I'm not properly qualified arguments on the Bible on that matter. But this also applies to other members of your family as well. I mean, would you apply the same thing to your wife, for example? I'm really deeply concerned about this.
Honorable Colette.
Chairperson, regarding this submission, it has got a lot of complications in as much as that if we can try an interrogate the decision, interrogate with it, we're going to take 6 months because there are a lot of things that really surprises one and, you know, confuses one. The first point, Chairperson, and again, Chairperson, is blessed with my head. Only to bless other people. And from the very Bible, there are verses that were there that say, thou shalt not use your hands to hurt him. That is why I'm saying, Chairperson, one can rather, you know, stay away from interrogating interpreters because it will cause a lot of time and a lot of tensions and a lot of everything. Chairperson, for instance, you know, if your child has done something wrong, something typically very, very wrong, and you know you're so furious and so hurt by the thing that's been done by the child, you cannot believe the amount of corporal punishment that you are going to use on the child. Provided we are saying when you are not cross, then you say, I'm going to hurt you, then you can't say, don't do that. But if really we say we separate punishment, because somewhere here I read across a phrase that says corporal punishment is a way of showing a child that you have now gone over the limit of you know, it's over the limit. Over the limit of doing wrong, of wrongdoing, yeah, of disrespect or wrongdoing or whatever, then you must apply. Now, when we state it in the Constitution to say, your child can steal sugar, you can break a glass, you can dodge spoons, you can do what, but next time, he'll do something that you think is over all these things. Then there's a clause in the Constitution that allows you for a corporal punishment. Really, what type of corporal punishment are you going to impose on the child? Because he shall have sinned above all sinners. Thank you, Chair.
Somewhere around the issue of why did the state get involved. And I just want to refer back to something that's in your proposal there. It says overreaching nature of the amended section 159. And so I just wanted to, I know that didn't come up, so stepping in, I'm understanding from what you're saying that stepping in to interfere in homes into the majority of homes where there's no abuse is the problem. Is that no one has a problem with the state getting in and dealing with situations where there's abuse. And that is actually not the majority of homes. But it is still way too many of us. But the state, so the sense here is that I would take from what you're saying is that you get getting a sense that the state in fact is copying out, trying to do some blanket little thing where in actual fact they need to be very specifically intervening where there are abusive, angry, uncontrolled parents doing things that have nothing to do with parental corporality. So the state, of course, I would take it then that needs to be restricted in terms of their interference and their intervening where there is no abuse. Okay. A comment was made about a wife and not a child, and just as a woman, I take great exception to that comment. As a wife, I am not a child. It has absolutely no relevance, and I'm really shocked that the Democratic Alliance would bring up such a really ridiculous comment. What I wanted to say...
I must protect the Democratic Alliance by saying that I don't recall them equating a woman to a child. I certainly didn't. Yeah, so I don't think the sample has to respond to that.
about the fury and the violence and the abuse, would you see any value in perhaps defining what the thing or defining this understanding of parental corporal punishment? For example, one of the submissions speaks about no child may be subjected to corporal punishment which in its manner or degree is cruel, inhuman, or degrading. Parental discipline or corporal punishment may be inflicted only in the following circumstances. It then goes on to list by a person who has parental responsibilities and rights in respect of the child, etc., in a moderate, reasonable, and restrained manner without anger, bearing in mind the child's age, maturity, and the circumstances of the offense. After the reason for the punishment has been explained to the child, using either an open hand or a soft object such as a light bottle, which stings but does not cause harm, is inflicted only on the child's open hand or buttocks. So the one problem that you didn't read was Hebrews 12:11, which says no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. My four children, my 33-year-old coming down to my 13-year-old, are really very special kids, very special adults, and they have all had the benefit of loving parents who have cared enough to actually train them up. And so they've had their experience with paddles and with snacks and with hiding. And I would say that the majority of families in South Africa, and we're not trying to undermine, I would say, that those families where there are problems, where they are dysfunctional, and where there has to be intervention, but don't wait for intervention, is what I'm hearing from your submission, by just putting everybody in the same box.
I'm worried we're way overboard in terms of time. I'm going to request that you don't attempt to, I think you may just want to summarize your report. But perhaps from the chair also, maybe you would assist me, and Honorable Bokhopane has alluded earlier. There is the question of discipline, but there's also the question of punishment. And perhaps we need to interrogate where one draws the line. Do they mean the same thing? Can they mean the same thing? Can the one be a precondition for the other? And after all, what is punishment? What is it intended? What should be the intention behind corporal and punishment? Is it intended to trigger a particular response, and what should that reaction?
I will be very brief. I think you touched exactly on the point. Corporal punishment is what it says, corporal punishment. It's corporal discipline. It means actual smacking of the body. That's what it says. And the issue is that it is supposed to address extreme cases of rebellion, extreme cases of open defiance against authority, especially authority as embodied in the parents, and authority as embodied in the parents as the representation of the authority of God. That is the point. And
if it fails to subdue that rebellion or that resistance,
then
you increase the amount of it. How do you do it?
There would come a time when it would become abusive. That we acknowledge. We acknowledge that there can be a corporal punishment that can be abusive. That doesn't mean to say that one has to continue just battering the child harder and harder or anything like that. That goes beyond the biblical lay down ground.
What happens?
So, ultimately, you probably get a delinquent. That's probably what happens. If I could just reply to the Honorable Gumede, Madam, with I beg your pardon? If, with respect, I think your understanding of biblical principles are not correct. It is not necessarily true that the Bible that says you may not use your hands to do any harm to other people. Yes, actually, the Bible says you may not do harm to other people. This is important. I'm glad that you raised that, because you actually gave me an opportunity to reply to something that I forgot to say. And that is to say that we do not have the option. This is a command of God. And if we are obliged to command God, or to obey God, or men, we have to obey God. The one thing that's come out in almost all the discussion, all the questions, is the fact that everybody here seems to equate corporal punishment in a loving home environment with abuse. There's a huge difference. There's a massive difference. We're not talking about the same thing. The honourable members are referring to something which we would reject as well, abuse. That's not what we're talking about. And yes, I deliberately didn't use the words when I drafted this presentation, but we are, because it sounds so cliche, but we are throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That is exactly what we're doing. To reply to, madam, I unfortunately don't know your name, but just to reply to you, there is no suggestion that violence against a woman would be in the same place. Violence against a woman is absolutely an unequivocal
sample.
I beg your pardon?
Honorable sample. The lady
Thank you. Surname, yeah, please be assured that our ethos would say that that is totally unacceptable. So even that, we're not even talking about the same thing. Things are simple parts. But and just finally to the Honourable Dadi, just to say yes, there might be some advantage in defining what is reasonable corporal punishment. That's possible.
Thank you. We're running terribly behind schedule, so we're going to have to build out through.
My one question is still not answered. I want to get to the sense, I know we're running out of time, but it's important to me that I understand why Christians, the constituencies that the presenter represents, still, why did government have to intervene? I need that, because I need to be able to engage with the presentation.
Can you quickly respond to that?
I don't know why the government had to intervene.
The question really is, in your mind, do you believe there was any rational basis that could possibly have informed government intervention, even though you might not agree with the manner in which that intervention came? Do you think that there should be something that makes the case for government, or is it completely irrational intervention that has absolutely no basis whatsoever?
I must assume, sir, that the legislature are rational people. I therefore must assume that they had a rational reason for doing this, and the obvious rationale would seem to be that they are trying to counter abuse, which is, again, what I said. So I'm an admitted attorney. There are enough laws to deal with abuse. You don't have to have the shotgun.
You acknowledge that there is a problem of abuse in the name of corporal punishment, in the family, in the home.
There would be abuse in the name of corporal punishment. We would say that is not corporal punishment, and if, never mind what you call it, if it is abuse, the law can deal with it. There are adequate laws to deal with it.
That suffices.
So you're saying that we don't need the children. We don't need to protect children against their families. That's what I'm... Children don't need the protection against their families. I mean, against their parents. Let me be very specific.
Children do need protection against abusive parents. Yeah. But there is law to deal with that. This is not the law to deal with that.
Okay, that's as far as we can take that exchange. We're going to have to move on. Please forgive us, members. Thank you very much for your contribution. Yes, Ms. Gumede. I didn't hear. His name is Mr. Rani. Okay, we shall proceed to the next presenter, presenter number 5. If they could please come forward, that is the Justice Alliance of South Africa, and there's a Mr. Tim Makamu. Yes, Makamu, yes. Makamu. Is that longer? Oh. Shewan Tata. Yes. We just, are you putting up now?
I put it
in. Meaning, sir.
Thanks. Chairperson and Honorable Minister, Members of Parliament, the public, and many of us who are coming to do a presentation, I'm quite aware that we just had a very tense moment. And I feel like we are in a hole in a moment, for a moment. So I'm hoping to bring us out of it so that we can be able to, you know, to proceed, you know, without emotions being so high, etc.
You'll bring some refreshing perspective that will be more stimulating.
I am definitely going to bring to you some reflective perspective, but I'm also going to give you some thought-provoking questions, which I am hoping you will take very seriously, because I don't think any of us here have got all the answers we need to bring as far as this bill is concerned. Let me just first say who I represent. My name is Tim Makamu. I'm here representing the Justice Alliance of South Africa. As you can hear, the word justice is quite critical in what we talk about, you know, whether it's applied to children, parents, individuals, etc., etc. My full-time job is I am a pastor at the East Kivu Christian Church. So majority of the views that we share obviously also come from there as well. And what I would do with this is I'm going to be drawing to attention two important questions that I said I need to ask. Not that you must answer them now, but in your deliberations in the next couple of weeks and months, bear those questions in mind. Then I will also share some of the practical stories that, you know, we go through on a daily basis. Maybe my own experience as well, you know, because having been born in a township, grown up in a rural school, you know how parents, how teachers used to treat us, and then now really learning the more appropriate way of child discipline, you know, it becomes very helpful. Then I would draw you to a study that was done in the USA and the topic was corporal punishment. And it was done by, you know, really people of diverse groups, those who were for, those who were against. And it would be good to, I don't know if you have utilized some of those materials, but I'll allude to that, to write it down so you can have a look at that. And then we'll finish with some recommendations. Now, I think it is good to state categorically very clear that we have a problem in South Africa. Children are being abused. That is the truth. And one of the honorable members did say that some of the abuses happen within homes. In fact, in Cape Town, we were with the premier the other day, and he was saying to us that the statistics show that 80% of the abuses that are happening to children, they are happening by members of the family that knows them. So those are things that are reality. And one of the honorable members asked a fundamental question, which is important for us to answer, because as a churchman and a pastor, it's important to take some responsibility of where we are faced. And that is, she asked the question, where were Christians when all these abuses have been happening and the state has to intervene? We are of the opinion, Chairperson, that the state does need to intervene because we have a problem in our country. Obviously, to what extent does the state need to interfere? That's the question that you guys need to answer for yourself. In our city, obviously, we've got issues of, we're looking at this problem in society. We say we would like to form part of addressing the situation. When I look at the bill itself, in totality, not just the section that we're dealing with, the bill is quite good, actually. You look at the number of things you're dealing with. You're dealing with early childhood development, which is excellent. Child protection, absolutely excellent. Child discipline, which is going to seek to propose some amendments in section 139, child safety, child labor, exploitation, child trafficking. So this bill is simply to protect those things that are there, and we endorse such a bill because we feel it's vital that we intervene. In our city, we do deal with childhood development. We've got a pre-primary school. We call it a key school. In fact, Chairperson, my son is turning 4 tomorrow. He is in the school, and we've got a partnership with the teachers in developing our sons. And we find that if the church and society play a major role, a positive role in child development, it's vital. We do that. And we've got a School of Hope, which seeks to take children who are in the streets and give them an education. And we're running that in Aston. And it's one of our ways of encouraging those kind of things. In fact, we are strong advocates of adopting children. We believe that if really we could encourage more parents to adopt children and raise children properly, we don't need many of these state institutions that we currently have. We do have them, obviously, because of the problem. But we need to think long-term beyond just trying to solve the now. And I will talk about that in a minute just now. Things like parenting seminars. I like what, the Reverend, I think it's Keith from the South African Council of Churches mentioned, that we do need to make sure that we educate society. But again, the question comes is, what do you educate people in? Is that important? Because majority of things we see on television, etc., they seek to educate, but they're educating people in a certain way. I believe that one of the things that our nation could benefit a lot in is really effective parenting, which obviously in our settings we do that. Now, Chairperson, I think the biggest problem we need to recognize is that South Africa is a young democracy. We are a very young nation. And we also come from a horrible past. That past was abusive. That past was disempowering to families. That past, I believe, it honored the people that need to be honored today, which are fathers. I believe that apartheid has played a major role in making sure that parents grow up without fathers, or which we have absent fathers, abusive fathers, or very busy fathers. You look at this room today, you're looking at pictures of heroines and many women who have done great things in society. Many of them didn't just fight for the struggle, but they had to walk around and raise children at the same time because the fathers either were in the struggle or they were in prison or they were absent. For me, that's one of the most fundamental problems we have in society. That is why question number one that I'd like you to write down and really think through as you deliberate in the next couple of weeks is, and this is important, is why do we have this big problem that we have in society? I submit to you that I believe one of the fundamental problems is that we do not have fathers in society. If you look at the current system and the working conditions in South Africa, which you all are part of, even members of parliament, you are very busy people, number one. Number two, many of you don't just have one job. You are a parliamentarian, and then you've got other private businesses that you do. That keeps you very busy, and it makes fathers to be absent from their children. And that is one of the fundamental problems we have in this country, which we need to look at and think through properly. A summary of our position is that we do commend government for upholding the rights of children, and we do as well affirm the government's role in wanting to protect children against what you term as the cruel, inhuman, and degrading forms of punishment, and that is very commendable. However, I think what we need to state quite importantly is that the government or U.S. lawmakers should not overstep your lawful sphere of jurisdiction in society when you begin to do that. What we feel needs to happen is that people like ourselves and others who are wanting to enhance and protect the children, we should work together and say what is the most appropriate way of building a great nation in the future. So these are the things that we'd like to have. Let me give one example in our church. In one of our children's churches, we have had a situation where a child, we've got children obviously coming from good homes, and children who come from orphanages and other places. We've had a situation where one child who comes from one of the orphanages was having an unruly behavior in the class. So the teacher began to come to try and come between the two of them. This child smacked the child who was, they were fighting, and smacked the teacher. And so when the teacher began to want to find out why did this happen, and they realized that one of the number one problems was that in that particular orphanage, which I won't mention the name of it, there was no discipline whatsoever. And by discipline, I'm not talking about corporal punishment. We're talking about, you know, discipline that needs to be administrated. There's no doubt that any nation needs disciplined citizens. And any home also needs disciplined children. The question we have here today is not whether or not corporal punishment is right or wrong. The question we all have here today is, what is the most appropriate form of discipline? And the issue is that we don't have all the answers. And therefore, we need to sit down and find out what is the best way of doing that. Yes, we do have examples and history and maybe the Bible to draw from as experience, which we do encourage that. But we need to eventually come to that place of what is then is the most appropriate form of discipline. That's what all of us are interested in. So we want to. I want to propose, as the Justice Alliance, obviously, and as the Episcopal Christian Church, submit to you what we believe is something you need to look at. And again, a study that I said I will refer you to is a consensus statement that was done by the members of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This was done in 1996. If you could write it down, it would be very helpful to assess, because you had people who were arguing. The subject was corporal punishment. And one of the statements that they said is that they came up with a three-day conference, and they came up with a 13-point consensus statement by the panel experts that were there. And this is important for us to obviously begin to understand what does it mean, you know, to discipline children or whatever. But however, the things that they said that they've said is that given a relatively healthy family life in a supportive environment, they were talking about obviously the issue of spanking a child, and they defined what spanking is, which I'll give it to you now. They said spanking in and of itself is not detrimental to a child or predictive of later problems. And one of the things that they were talking about, and as far as spanking is concerned, what they were describing was spanking as opposed to general corporal punishment. They said it is defined as a physical, non-injurious, intended to modify behavior and administrator to the extremities or to the buttocks. Now, that is something to think through, and as far as the definition of that. In my own life, like I said, my son is turning four tomorrow. My son, the last 2 years, you know, the two-year-old and three-year-old, how they behave. I do want to state very clearly that I do spank my child. But this is the reason why I do it. I discourage the wrong behavior in my child. That's what I do. And I explain to my son, what you did to your mother was wrong. And because I said to you several times now, I need to sit down with you and administrate spanking. Now, where do I do it? I take him to the bathroom. That's the most appropriate place. Not public place, because that's degrading to him. Not in his bedroom, because that's a place of comfort for him. So the first thing I do, I explain to him what he did was wrong. Therefore, daddy is going to discipline him. So I take him to the bathroom, go to his bathroom, and I administrate spanking. When I finish, I embrace him, because he's my son. I love him.
How often do you do it?
Once again, it's not about how often you do it. It's what are you trying to instill in the child that is important. So you don't do that every day or every week or whatever. It's a case of my son has done an offense and was received.
I'm not going to insist that you answer the question, but the question was asked, how often do you do it?
If you ask how often have I done it this week, I haven't done it this week. Thank you. So, in other words, what I shared now is not really the fact of spanking of a child; it's the principle of doing it. Because when you provide answers, what is the most appropriate way of disciplining children, and what education do you want society to have? This may well be some of the things we may want to include in those things as we educate our society on how to do it. Now, without wasting any time, let me just say there was an opponent of thinking called Elizabeth Geshel from Columbia University's National Center of Children in Poverty, conducted a 5-year study analyzing 6 decades of research on corporal punishment. And she stopped short of endorsing a legal ban on parenting and spanking. She was also not able to assess spanking, obviously, as a cause of the commonly claimed negative behavioral outcome, such as increased aggression in children. Peer review of Geshel's work concluded that the evidence presented in the meta-analysis does not justify a blanket injunction against mild or moderate disciplinary spanking. So these are some of the studies that, as you deliberate as a committee, please have a look at them, because they will help you as we find out solutions of this. So can I then propose, what then do we propose, because our proposal is only one section, 139, and it's only two subsections, subsection 2 and subsection 3. What we feel will be the most appropriate wording of that subsection will be, number one, no child may be subjected, and again, we want to remove the word corporal punishment because of what has happened, and I agree with the chairperson that it has been abused in our schools. I remember our teachers not just clapping us, but beating us in a very degrading way. I remember those days, those moments. So therefore, I think the most appropriate term could well be discipline. So we might say, no child may be subjected to discipline which in its manner or degree is cruel, inhuman, or degrading. Because it's not just the corporal punishment we're dealing with. There's also verbal discipline that can be very abusive and psychologically damaging to a child. So if we can use that word discipline, that could maybe be very helpful. And then if we say discipline of children, subsection 3, we are suggesting that it can be proposed in the following circumstances. Number 8, by a person with parental responsibilities and rights in respect to the child, and who acts in accordance with subsection 1 hereof. B, in a moderate, reasonable, and restrained manner, without anger, bearing in mind the child's age, maturity, and the circumstances of offense. So that this would take education. C, after the reason for the discipline has been explained to the child. D, using either, and obviously in the case of spanking, in the way we are proposing to do it, either we use a flat object or an open hand, or such as a light pedal, which the Honorable was alluding to earlier, which stings but does not cause any bodily harm. And finally, is inflicted or applied, as far as spanking is concerned, only in the head of a child or in the buttock. So let us conclude by just saying the following, Chairperson, that as we find better ways of disciplining children, let the legislators and the parliament and government partner with families as we find ways to protect children. And secondly, we suggest that we work and partner with churches and religious organizations, finding ways in the future of how we can educate people once we have discovered what is the most appropriate way of discipline to educate society in that regard. Thirdly, I think, Chairperson, I know you were talking about we have got a new Africa and a new church. I submit to you that there is no such a thing as a new church. The church is the same as it was founded, obviously, by the founder himself, the King, Jesus Christ. It is the people who change all the time in our views and opinions. So the other thing, of course, is the Africa. I would like to believe that the values of Africa should not change, because values are who you are, Chairperson. You cannot change who you are, and you shouldn't. But the problem is we have not been able to uphold our values, because we have been violated by many things, apartheid, war, colonialism, imperialism, etc. However, we need to come back to those things. So those are our submissions. Thank you.
Is thanking a value, or is it
no.
an act?
No, not a value. Thanking is not a value.
Okay, no. I did not want you to respond to
okay.
that. look, I think that we do have serious time constraints. And we're going to have to be brutal in terms of cutting people. And I'm going to urge my colleagues as well that we, including myself, we try to restrain ourselves in our comments and the length of the questions we make. But I nevertheless do need to give people an opportunity to interact. So it's up for grabs. Ms. Laba has already indicated. created like that with you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for that really nice presentation. I would just like to say that I think very often we're taking this very much overboard. Corporal punishment is bad. But I have yet to see a judge or a policeman when a little toddler of four runs into the police station and says, "My daddy has just spanked my bottom." Now, what is going to happen in that case? You really think the policeman is going to take down the statement and rush off to the house. But if the child comes in with burn marks all over him and cuts all over him and says, "My daddy just abused me," well, obviously that is the case. So I think we've got to take this sort of thing a bit more into context. And I think that we do have to have this in the bill so that we are sending a really clear message out that we are not going to stand for abuse. Because we do come from a very abusive society. So I don't think that we can have a whole chapter on saying, right, you can spank your child because you did this. You can spank your child because you did that. You cannot do it. And I think also where somebody has referred to extreme. Now, what is extreme? How do you define extreme? I mean, to a person who works his hands off to buy a glass and the child breaks the glass, that is extreme. But to somebody else who's wealthy and his son takes his car and bashes it into a pole, well, that is also extreme. So how do you define extreme? So I think we've got to see this whole bill in context that actually within reason. And I think that people have got to be educated by who's going to do the educating. Thank you, Chair.
Any further comments or comment questions? Yes, Ms. Dutton.
Do you think that this educating that needs to be done can be done without banning parental corporal punishment? Do you think that the educating that needs to be done around abusive and abusive parents or dysfunctional homes need the change in the legislation? I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. How do you see corporal punishment as being consistent with the notion that in the Constitution that nobody may be subjected to degrading, abusive punishment? There used to be a time in our legal system before 1994 when part of the sentence that could be imposed would be expressly a number of lashings that you would be subjected to. And they would be administered in a particular form and all of that. They're supposed to be in a dignified way. But it was lashing. Now, it was abolished even before this, if my memory serves me, because it was just so dehumanizing, so degrading. You are saying that lashing your own son, or I don't know whether it's a daughter, is it a daughter? It's a son.
It's
a
son.
Is it a son? He
turns four tomorrow.
He turns four tomorrow. And you're taking your four-year-old son to the bathroom and take a rod and spank him on the bottom. I suspect that you may be admitting to a criminal offense. I must say that I will not encourage you to give any further details, because we might not be able to protect you from, we might not be able to give you criminal immunity. The Powers and Privileges Act only protects members of Parliament. Free speech. I'm not sure whether people getting evidence for a committee of parliament are necessarily equally safe than it. So as an advocate, I would encourage you not to give to reveal too much detail about your personal family circumstances and stick to your presentation. But please proceed and respond to the question.
Chairperson, I will start with your question, with what you just said now.
Yes,
please know that I did not say lashing at my son. That is not what I said. Second,
spanking.
Yes, I use the word spanking because
I don't know what spanking means. That's English is a second language.
Myself, define it again.
I'll be educated.
I can define it again because I did earlier in my presentation.
Oh, you, yeah.
The mothers understand.
Please respond and then let's go.
Yeah. Just very briefly, Chairperson. On the contrary, I don't like that term corporal punishment. I don't believe we should encourage that either. My proposal to you as legislators and lawmakers, why don't we use the term child discipline? Because then you can look at a holistic approach of that. Because everything you've defined so far, like me walking in the mall and I find a mother smacking the child all over the park, I disagree with it. I don't believe that is appropriate for the child. That is degrading. It is embarrassing to the child. So therefore, I think if we can maybe start, as far as parenting is concerned, we use the word child discipline. So we can empower parents. Because you as lawmakers, you've got the two jobs. That's why we voted for you.
Personally, I don't find it any less humiliating, any more humiliating than the picture you've just painted. But conclude your response.
Chairperson, I would like to engage in this over lunch, personally. Yeah. But just to conclude in my part, I think when we voted you as parliamentarian and legislator, you've got two responsibilities. Responsibility number one, you need to make sure that when you pass laws, they are there to regulate and discipline bad behavior and people who are not law-abiding. So anybody who violates need to be punished by a law or whatever so that they can feel that, you know, that what they're doing is wrong. The second thing, which is your role, we want to leave you with is you must also commend those that are doing good in society. In other words, if there are families or parents that are training children, that will be useful in society. We need to say we commend that. We want to, like the Honorable said earlier, this legislation is actually here to commend those parents that are doing good. We say we want to help you do it better. And finally, Chairperson and all Honorable Ministers, members, we want to make sure that we leave a good legacy for the next generation. Therefore, while we are reacting to the current problems of violence, etc., we need to make sure that what kind of a legacy do we want to leave so that our children and children's children who want to take this nation to another level, they find us having laid the right principles for them to do so. So I want you to think through properly as you go through this process in the next few weeks. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take the last presentation before we go for lunch. I agree we must commend those that do good, provided that they indeed do good. But on that note, can we get to the next presenter, who is presenter number 6, and that is South African Congress for Early Childhood Development and Early Learning Resource Unit. And the presenter is Ms. Blossom Wevela. The stage is yours.
Honourable Chairperson and Members of Parliament, thank you for giving us this opportunity today. I am Mary Newman, and this is Blossom Wevela. She will tell you more about the work that she's doing, because essentially our presentation today is going to be a very practical one based on what is actually happening. We put a lot of work into our submission, and we wish to commend you for the work that you have done on behalf of Early Childhood Development over these long years that we've been working together on this bill. Certainly we have seen changes, we have seen far more political will in terms of early childhood development and a general acceptance that it's a very important area of not only human development, but of the development of the preventative services as the basis for how we deal with our children in this country. So I'm not going to take up too much of your time because we actually want to focus on some of the practicalities that we hope you will look at very carefully when you come to finalise this bill in terms of this section of early childhood development.
Okay, as Mary was in the group, myself as Blossom Wazena, I am experienced I'm an experienced trainer of ECD in the community, working in the Western Cape and Eastern Cape, but we are originally here in Cape Town. And from the listening of our submission today, that is from ELRU. ELRU stands for Early Learning Resource Unit and the South African Congress. The background of this work, the progress of this work is mainly at policy level, as 84% of children are unreached by ECD provision. And on that note, I want to highlight three clauses today. The clauses I'm going to talk about is focused on is the clause 91, 93, and 95. And because we're running out of time, Honorable Chair, I just want to focus on the clause 95, registration of ECD facilities. And it's very difficult because, as we all know, that ECD facilities are difficult to be funded. And there are a lot of ECD facilities, and many ECD programs serving the poorest communities are unlikely to have the funds and resources unless they become registered and subsidized. On that note, we feel that the registration process is delaying, and the registration process is frustrating at grassroots level. And the registration process is at times annoying, because as ECD service providers, we are doing the training, and we want the implementation and the progress of our program. But when we get there in the ECD programs or facilities, they have nothing, no resources, or unlimited resources. And we don't see the reflection of our training of our ECD services. Therefore, we appeal that the registration must be simplified and coordinated in single process, which is very flexible and open. I just want to make a typical example. Last year, there was a pilot program which was initiated by the MEC of Social Development, where the focus areas was Philippines. And we also worked on horticulture, Egoli Township, and Olibon, whereby it was a hands-on research on ECD programs. But the thing came up is that there are no resources. We tried by all means to have alternate programs, like training programs, like schools who can afford, can be changed with the underprivileged ECD sites. But things are going well at the moment, but it's still a pilot. And then from that registration, we're trying so that it's not just a free give and take, but they are learning. And they also, they must improvise and do things to alternate registration because we are under-resourced. And if they are under-resourced, the registration won't happen. And we have an imbizo of people, of ECD practitioners, whereby they didn't know the process of registration, and the forms they are given are not friendly users because they have to go to a neighbor, they have to go to someone in a former school to be assessed in this filling in of the time people have to disclose their confidentiality of the school because they cannot fill in their cert themselves. And that's why I highlight the registration, because if we cannot, the process or delay the process of registration, the ECD programs or services will not progress in our under-resourced community. And then the second part I want to emphasize is the definition of, it's a clause 93, the obligation to nutrition. It's very important that the government or the social development officials must be committed to this. Because I have another scenario, or I have another story to tell in the what happened in the Eastern Cape. When we visited the school, there was a name on paper of the school, but when we got there, the children were under the tree. They were the 3 to 5 year olds. I'm not talking about the crackers. They were the 3, 4 to 5 year olds. And the teacher was a teenage girl, had her child on the back. There was nothing happening. I had to collect it and send and save the class so that they have sent a way of writing using their feet. There was a nearby school, primary school, in the 2 roundabouts. When it was lunchtime, the primary school came out, and there were old mamas there were smearing the peanut butter on the quarter, the loaf, and cut into 4. They called quarters. And the primary schools were queuing for these quarters. And when I asked about what is happening to the little ones, the 3 to 4 year olds, they said they are not allowed to get them. It was very sad because I had to pop out 20 rands of my pocket and give the teacher so that she can send someone to the shop and buy for the children. And when I left, I was crying. I asked myself, who's going to give that 20 rands tomorrow? It was very sad. So I appeal that the government should be responsible in providing the funds. Most certainly successes and programs.
I think our last point of concern is that we note that ECD is still in this bill covering the period from birth to school-going age. And we do want to alert you again to the fact that in terms of the international instruments and the guidance on the UN bill, we are not conforming with those instruments. And it is our belief that this work should encompass all children up to the age of 9 years, because if it stays in its present form where the children are only considered from birth until 6 years, it leaves out all those programs that in fact deal with children with disabilities. We in fact have argued in our report that we speak about chronological rather than biological age of the children, and also that we take into consideration the needs of the children outside of school hours, which would also which are often also subsidized by the Department of Social Development. I think those are the main concerns. We don't want to take you step by step through the whole bill because we have already, and you've got it in front of you. and we would like, we are available to answer any questions.
Thank you. That's exemplary, very brief and concise. I'd encourage other presenters to do likewise. I'm going to allow a very brief interaction with this submission. Honorable Bokupani, followed by Honorable Dudley, and I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you very much, sir. I just want to say it very briefly. The first one is, when we say, because we said school going age, which is assumed is 6, because at 7 you go into grade 1, and then you're requesting that we stipulate an age in the act. I just want to make sure I understand that because at the moment we did not put an age. It says up to school going age. And then with regards to children with disabilities, you know, I've got a 4-year-old who's visually impaired just like me. And I at the moment she's in a preschool. I'm just trying to say, to try and understand what is the understanding. And I've heard this with the different presenters, and I'm beginning to get very confused. Firstly, as a disabled person, and as a parent of 2 disabled children, because this is very confusing for me. When we say children with disabilities, you know, because my belief is that we need to concentrate on getting the system to be fixed so that that disabled child arrives at that ECD center at the same age with others. Because their effect, I mean, you have peers who are in grade 12, you're only in grade 12 at 20. That in itself is wrong. It's degrading for a lot of disabled children. Some of us have gone through that, and I don't think I want to recommend it for anybody. But I'm saying, what are the presenters recommending? Because I keep on getting disabled children. Would the recommendation not be that we make sure that ECG is accessible to a disabled child at the same age with others? That's one. But the second part should be, and that is where I think the confusion comes, is that when a child has a particular disability, that would deprive and delay the child. But that can't be ECD, because even though a child would be 15 with the mind of a 12-year-old, of a 5-year-old, I mean, from a human rights perspective, I'm sorry, Chair, I'm just rounding. From a human rights perspective, I don't think that 18, 19, 20-year-old mentally disabled person with the mind of a 4-year-old would want to be in a preschool with 4-year-old children. So all I'm trying to say is sometimes when we make this, especially around disability, they need, it should be about the system being fixed so that it brings the equality and recognizes the special needs while it does that, rather than us saying we're extending the age so that we want to welcome that one that came in late, because that is what is the problem, why the child came late in the first place. And I mean, I'm talking from experience because I'm fighting with everybody across the board to get ECG for my 4-year-old. I can't imagine if I'm fighting at this level what happens to other parents who are not even at the point of being able to pay, because I don't mind the pay.
Yeah, I think that the other context to this issue is that you have a national policy on special education. And that policy, incidentally, I was one of the commissioners who served on that commission that produced that report, is that we envisaged a situation where the mainstream education system would be so dynamic as to accommodate diversity, so that within that single system, there is room for so-called gifted children, for so-called slow learners, for so-called learners that learn more easily with visual as opposed to oral forms of tuition, etc.
And I think that the same principle would also relate to the question of ECD as part of this continuum of learning from childhood to adulthood. And maybe the question one is, within the new ECD systems that we're talking about, to what extent have we systematically factored in the notion of inclusivity, but within the broader continuum of learning across the different phases of development, how have we addressed special needs or barriers for, including disability, different kinds of disability. But Mr. Dudley, yes, you had a question.
Not only the presentation was very good, but the document itself was well laid out and very useful, and I'm sure in our deliberations it's going to be very useful. But could I just point out that pages 11 to 15, 18 and 19 are just a blank and what, and so if we are going to be able to use that information, these members will probably need a proper document, a corrected document. That's the thing.
Could briefly respond.
Okay, from what another book, the member of parliament says, just says, you need to know that when a child arrives, when a disabled child, once you see a disabled child arrives with the same age with other children, as normal children, that will be impossible because the learning and the development of a disabled child is differ from the pace of the development.
What she's explaining is that the concept early childhood is exactly what it is. It's about the early stages of childhood. But that is distinct from a situation where you have a child, say, with, I'm not sure if this is the proper term, mental retardation, for example, who may no longer be a child for that matter, or may be no longer be an early child in the immediate, but who needs the kind of learning and support which is different from peers of her age, okay? But that should not be equated to early childhood development, because that person is not longer an early child, if you like. So I think that is really the issue. To say, what are you people proposing? I'm saying that people who are learning slowly must then be stuck in early childhood development program in perpetuity, regardless of the age, just because the mental development is at a slower pace than the other. But you don't have to
answer that now.
To answer the question if they are beyond you. If you feel that it's within your capacity to respond to a specific issue, feel free to do so, but you don't have to provide the answer.
I just wanted to say, you see, that's what I was asking. The general notion that just because the child is disabled, the child cannot access. You see, and that is what excludes disabled children. The fact that you're deaf, you're blind, it assumes that your mind even works slower. And if you see my Zanele at 4, I can promise you she is 100% even faster than any other without visual impairment. So that is what part of the problem we are dealing with. And I would expect the Congress for ECD to begin with the first one to say that disabled children, just by virtue of their disability, the fact that they have nothing, does not say there's something wrong with their brain from birth. So we say if ECD is made available to somebody from 1 month, so it be. And that's what we want to hear from the Congress. Not that their disability should begin to say they are slow anyway.
I now understand why she wants the answer, because you are called the Congress. So you come across as an umbrella body. So you
you, you should be providing the answers and nobody else.
I think that, you know, to answer you, first of all, I think that our whole submission has been extremely inclusive. And in fact, ECD has for many years argued the importance of inclusivity. And we have worked very closely with the organizations that represent the disabled in order to, you know, dovetail our submission. I also want to say that we have also argued that it's very important, though, to in fact not prescribe this age differential. We would prefer to see age as being as making a distinction in favor of chronological rather than biological age, because in that way one can allow for some of the differences in this early phase of development rather than create a situation where children are just you know, left with nowhere to go. I also want to say that I think a third response to that has been that we have consistently put forward our concern that these chapters should be better integrated, so that the whole section on prevention, which where you get a lot of the health initiatives, early screening and that sort of thing, should in fact run side by side with early childhood development. Early childhood development is not just about preschool centres and some of these issues which you brought up today, which are important about extending access to especially those large numbers of children who desperately need access. But it's also about bringing those preventative services closer to ECD centres. And there's no one one sort of model that suits all. It's about a very comprehensive plan that in fact takes into account the needs of all children within this cohort of children. So the child, even the child before birth, is someone that we need to recognize as needing special support services. And this early screening would be a very particularly important service, because the earlier that we can screen for disability or setbacks or developmental lag, the better we can do to help children come on board. I'd just like to also say that I've also had very personal experience of this, in that I have a grandson who was who suffered from epilepsy at the age of 18 months, and I saw the huge advantages of being able to put him in a special situation which enabled language, which was completely lost at a very critical point of his development. He was then fortunate in Johannesburg to be able to be streamed into a school at the age of 3, which helped with language development and rebuilt that language development. So we are saying that ECD services encompasses all of this, that one is not always talking about just bringing a disabled child or a child of some kind of developmental lag into a preschool. Yes, if that suits, if that can work. But we're also saying that those children need the support that would give them an opportunity to come on board, be it a wheelchair or any special facility. So ECD, yes, to answer your question, it does cover the wide range of needs of children, whatever their needs are during this age cohort.
Can I say that we do have a time-constrained crisis? We still have 10 submissions to plow through today. We've only done 6 for the morning session. So we have a situation where we may have to work a bit longer than usual. I see us going beyond 5 o'clock already. So I'm going to plead firstly with colleagues that they brace themselves for a long day, but also request presenters that in the interest of their own point of view being being absorbed, they stick to the core issues that they want to highlight and not attempt to
to present everything that is already contained in their written submission. We're going to break for lunch now, and we suggest that we proceed as follows. The old assembly dining hall will not be able to accommodate all of us. Some of us would have to go to Matt's building. Somebody would direct you how to get there. So the same food, the same ambience. So don't feel that you are second class when you're sent to Matt's building. The prestigious restaurant as well. So some people will go to Matt's building, about 25, and the rest of the people will stay in the old assembly. I'll lead the group that goes to my school. Excellent.